I just want a blue black jellyfish lord.
What the fuck did you just say?
What?
How many creature type jellyfish are there? One? Is Manowar a jellyfish?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's three.
Even though a Manowar isn't a jellyfish.
There's two Gomazoas and a jellyfish.
People don't know that.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Untapped Podcast. I'm your host, Paul. Like an Urza's Rage kicked when your opponent has Urza's armor, this is Take 9.
I don't get it.
I like it.
With me tonight is Kaz.
Like a stuffy doll flashed in with scout's warning to block a void winner, this is Take 9.
I still...
That's all odd, by the way. It works.
A very odd suggestion.
Is it a joke?
Shut up. Rudely with me tonight is Goodspeed.
Yeah, like casting friendly fire and they reveal Sim Sig Muck Draggers.
I don't know either of those cards.
Oh, Jesus.
A friendly fire had the best flavor text in all of Khan's block.
Never tell goblins to fire at will.
Alright, I know what this card.
And last but not least, Ed.
Like casting increasing vengeance from your graveyard at a spearing spear, this is Take 9.
I still don't get it.
Increasing vengeance from your... Okay, yeah. That's
all right, yeah.
It makes two copies of the searing spear, which means you get hit by three searing spears. They all do three damage.
Oh.
This is something that I did in Standard a while ago.
Yeah, I was thinking cool. You actually did that in a deck.
And sometimes it was with the goblin on the field. That was a fun deck. Whatever.
So, who wants to talk about spoilers?
Not me, because it sucks.
I'll say my one review based off the spoilers I've seen. For some reason, it seems like blue... This is at this point. Granted, we haven't seen many of the commons. We haven't seen, you know, many of anything, really. It seems like blue has become the looting color, and green has become the drawing color from everything I've read.
So,
green is an unconditional draw, though. It's normally only a useful card.
There are two green cards I know of, and one of them draws one card, and it's a bad enchantment.
No, it's another one. There's a... Oh, yeah, right. The other bad enchantment is the other one.
The other one is Oath of Nissa.
The other one is a marginally less bad enchantment.
That doesn't exactly draw a card, but I'll give that the benefit of the doubt. It basically does.
It's like
if you whip with that, your deck sucks. You're not playing it right.
or you hit three. Oh, wait, does it take a land?
Yes.
Yeah,
then you fucked up.
Or you hit three Oath of Nissa.
I mean, at that point, are you upset that you got to put three Oath of Nissas on the bottom of your library?
Does it go to the bottom? I don't even...
I think so.
Yeah, it goes to the bottom of your library.
Yeah.
It's not putting anything in the graveyard. Ooh,
that would be really, really good for one mana. If I put two to three cards in the graveyard.
I really want a dredge back.
It would be like a Seder Wayfinder, except, you know...
Worse.
I love Seder Wayfinder.
I forgot how bad that card was in Limited in Theros. It was like the worst. Seder Wayfinder.
It wasn't great.
It was... So I'm watching a bunch of Born of the Gods drafts because I have no life. I know. But the joke is that it was so bad in Limited, and it was really, really good in Constructed. Just hilarious.
Which when you look at the card, like... I don't know.
I was thinking about how much I miss Abzan Control. I actually miss Corsair of Prefix. I hate to say it.
What strategy, like, do you, like, you just hate that it's Abzan Aggro now?
No, I like Abzan Aggro, it's just not as interesting. The great part about Abzan was you had, like, eight different kinds of Abzan decks.
Oh,
and now there's two, at most. So,
well, they're all playing Siege Rhino, so...
Yes.
Returning to Ed's point.
Sure.
I think that he might be overstating the case a little bit here. Blue has at least two cards that draw cards, and they both let you draw more than one card.
Do they make you discard them?
There's one spell you're thinking of that is looting, but there's two mono blue cards that let you draw cards, and there's two blue and something else cards that let you draw cards.
You counting?
Are they one drops?
I was thinking of a one drop as one of the blue and something else cards.
How could it be a one drop if it's a blue and something else?
Phyrexian mana, shut up.
I'm sorry, you just...
Prophet of Distortion, obviously.
And it's somehow blue and something else and still only one mana?
Yeah, look it up.
One blue devoid. used.
It has an activated ability that costs 4 unless you draw cards.
Are you counting?
So...
yeah.
So I'm going to be honest, I didn't spend a whole lot of time looking at this for cube possibilities, but is there anything you guys are like excited about? Shut up, please.
I'm not...
I'm mad enough
I'm convinced.
Are you serious?
We talked about it. I love it. I think it's great.
There's no reason we can't try it.
Yeah, okay. Whatever.
Any Super Friends deck is going to be green-based. We know that.
I don't know that I want to push Super Friends in cube. It just seems like the most annoying mid-range deck to play against.
We have Merciless Eviction in cube, right?
Planeswalkers are already good enough without making Planeswalkers better. Like, yeah, they're not hurting much for, you know, playability.
It feels like all of them together isn't that good. I don't know. Yeah, they're all so bad.
No, I like that on Mythic Spoiler, it goes, Oath of Gideon, Oath of Jace, Oath of Chandra, Oath of Nyssa, Drana's Chosen. As the cycle.
I'm hoping they fill in Obnixilus' Oath, but they're not going to, because
not gonna happen.
They're not fun.
Would you be okay if they created some kind of anti-Oath card with Obnixilus?
I'd be, like enchantment removal?
In black.
Not in black, but it would be like Betrayal of Obnixilus or something.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Or like, Treacherous of Ob, or Treachery of Ob, or something.
Black did get an artifact removal card, and the opponent had to sacrifice, like, the artifact if they, like, tapped it or something. Like, it was something weird, like, you put it on an artifact, and then
what,
they have to pay life or they sacrifice it.
What set was this from?
It was from Corset.
What year?
I don't know. I can look it up if you want.
Crux of Fate can kill enchantments if there's a sigil of the whatever. Oh, but Starfield of Nyx in play. Is that what I'm thinking of?
Probably.
Yeah, and black can kill those enchantments dead. Starfield of Nyx and 4 Oath of Nyssa.
So, you already expressed your displeasure with the set, Goodspeed.
Yes, it sucks. This block sucks. It's terrible.
There is one card.
Fuck.
There is one card you gave a shit about.
Was it Man of War?
No.
Was it Man of Victory?
I want Enthralling Victor back.
What card are we talking about? Because I don't remember.
Goblin Dark Dwellers.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah, the greatest card ever printed. Oh, my God. I already bought a playset.
Did you forget that it's in the set that hasn't come out yet?
Yeah, I kind of did. It feels like it was in a different set, because it came out, like, 2 weeks ago. Maybe 3 weeks ago at this point. And I will say, the only cards in this block I like, or in this set I like, are red. And there might be a reason for that.
Did you look at the colorless spells?
Yeah, I don't understand. I don't know how to evaluate the new...
The 4 and 5 drops are obscene. They all have trample.
Please call cards out individually. So
Reality Smasher looks like a great rare. If you open it, you're going to play it.
So Reality Smasher...
I'm talking about sealed here. I'm not talking about constructed. I have no idea what the range on those things are going to be. But
Reality Smasher is a 5/5 trample haste for 4 and a colorless, and it has whenever Reality Smasher becomes the target of a spell an opponent controls, counter that spell unless its controller discards a card.
Is it a rare?
Yes.
Okay. So, do we know how the colorless mana works in sealed with wastes?
Yes.
Do we ever get a definitive answer on that?
You get wastes that are in your pool.
That's it?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought. I don't know how to evaluate this kind of mana in any format because of that.
If it just requires, like, a card like Endbringer, which I fucking love to death,
yeah,
like my favorite card from the set, it's going to require, might be harder, but, like, requiring just a single colorless, I don't think that's going to be that. Especially in Seal, I don't think that's going to be that.
Well, yeah, I think if you can get incidental Scions, it's
fine. But there's, like, a lot of stuff they released.
How many sources of a color would you need to play to splash it normally?
6-ish.
No.
5 is good.
5 or 6, yeah.
7 is great with the secondary color at that point.
Yeah.
If you're talking about, like, any sources of colorless mana, like even cards that make Scions,
right,
I don't think it's unreasonable.
So far, they have 3 colorless lands,
mm-hmm,
that make colorless mana that are common.
Okay. And there's that artifact that just got spoiled.
They have Hedron Crawler and Seer's Lantern, both of which are common, which create colorless mana.
I want to clarify that you're not counting Waste, even though it's a common in the set twice.
Yeah, and Waste
so
twice.
We have 5 common colorless lands.
And you're also opening some number of Battle for Zendikar packs during this sealed event.
Are we?
Yes.
Yeah, you're opening 2.
I think it's 2-4.
Because I remember sometimes they just go for the whole 6 on a pre-release because people just want to play with the new cards.
So regardless of, and this is the point there, is regardless of the number of devoid creatures, etc., that they print, we know that Battle for Zendikar has a lot of Scion producers in it.
Yeah. I think I'm going to take a chance at the pre-release
and try to play my good colorless spells, no matter what my deck, what two colors I'm playing normally.
They just seem very strong.
Yeah, they're really the strongest cards in the set, I think, but in terms of limited.
So far.
From what we've seen. I mean, and there's a lot of build rounds. We don't know the commons. We don't know the uncommons. We want to see what the removal's like for the set before we make, you know, big judgments.
They just printed a new removal spell today.
I actually really like that one.
There are also, you know, like 18 ultra mythic rares in the set that can, if you cast your colors.
You mean Nissa, Protector of Zendikar? I have no idea what that card's actually called.
No, I mean Wastelands.
Oh, wait, what?
He's talking about any of the expeditions.
If I get one of those, I'm not playing it in my deck.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. I'm putting it right in my binder.
No way. You gotta show off.
None of these are expensive.
Okay, you're right.
Wasteland?
Are you kidding me?
Wasteland is. Tech Edge is 25.
All of these are going to be at least $50.
So six
promo versions.
16 of the 20 expeditions do let you cast colorless spells for whatever fraction of decks that helps.
Okay, Forbidden Orchard, probably some money. Tech Edge is not much though.
Just for being an alt art expedition, it's probably going to be expensive. But
I don't think that card is going to be more than $10.
Mm. It'll be more than $10.
That just doesn't make sense.
I may be overdoing it with 50, but I think it'll be more than $10.
I expect it to be more than $30.
That's lowest over 3,000 times the actual price of the normal card.
This is like alt art and shiny and expedition and nobody.
Look at like Judge promos. It should be comparable to that because this is comparable in rarity.
I have no idea if that's true.
These might be more rare?
I have no idea if that's true. I'm really not sure.
I mean, when you have, it's like about a 1 in 100 chance to open one, and there's, what, 30 of them?
A 1 in 100 packs? That's true. That seems really...
How many packs are in a booster box?
36.
Yeah, because you gotta eat... I thought the idea was you had to buy 3 booster boxes, and you would probably get one expedition. That's what I remember it being for the last set.
I don't actually remember how...
It was... So if I remember correctly, the stats on getting an expedition were however many packs there are for Mythic Rare. It was 1 in 18 Mythic Rares is an expedition.
No, it was the chance of getting a foil Mythic Rare.
Which was a 1 in 18 for a Mythic Rare.
Like 5/3 or something, because there's more expeditions than Mythic Rares.
This is crazy math.
It was interesting.
I explained it.
I thought foils weren't done by rarity.
What is this crazy math?
Foils are done by rarity.
Celsius to Fahrenheit.
Yeah, but I like memorize the formula. It's different.
There are not as many foils of a Mythic Rare as there are foils of a common in the world.
Really?
Absolutely.
I always thought they used the same sheets and they just didn't care when they made them. I don't know.
To be honest, they use the same
sheets that they print regular cards on, which means they need many fewer Mythic Rares. There's a shitload more commons.
But that shouldn't change the amount, the absolute number.
The chance of opening a Mythic Rare,
sure,
is 1 in 8 packs.
Yeah.
You get about 10 commons in every pack.
Sure.
So there are 80 commons for every, like 80 foil commons for every foil mythic, just based on that math.
Okay, but here's...
You're talking a ratio of 10 to 1/8, so I fixed the math.
I know, but besides the math, but just for a comparison, my foil Eleshnorn, which is in near mint condition, is worth $50. The card by itself, a normal Eleshnorn, is worth 15. A normal Tech Edge...
I have a different comparison for this. I love this example, though.
I do, too, and I already know where he's going. I don't know what the card is.
A normal Tech Edge is worth, what, a 75 cents?
This isn't a foil Tech Edge.
This is much closer to a Phyrexian Eleshnorn, which is worth $600. I mean, it's not quite that. I think it's somewhere between a foil Eleshnorn and a Phyrexian Eleshnorn judge promo.
How much?
No, because that would make the Tectonic Edge worth, like, $300.
Yeah, it's not going to be that
much. I said it would be between...
Not from 25
4 times... And 40 times the price. That's a pretty generous range.
Brain Games would be proud.
Because Phyrexian Eleshnorn is $600.
That's what I said. Were you not listening?
No, I was looking it up.
I said, this is more like a judge promo than just like a regular Tectonic Edge foil, like a pack foil.
Alternatively, counterpoint, compare it to the Ugin's Fate promos.
Which ones?
Exactly.
Ugin?
Because besides Ugin, none of them are worth jack shit, I don't think.
I think the Ugin's Fate promos are much more plentiful, because everyone who went to the pre-release played the game to get them.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that is true.
They were also in people's hands on 0 day, where expeditions will only eke into the system over time.
You are correct, though. That was a good comparison in terms of dividing by price. It is about 30 and 25.
It has a calculator
percent increase. Oh, yeah, I pulled a calculator out. I was curious.
I guess my main question with these foliars right now is that we talked before about, like, how are we going to get, like, colorless mana, like, consistent in the cube, and how we're going to work with it. Are there any colorless cards that people are legitimately excited to be in the cube, right, as of right now, like, colorless requiring cards?
Warping Whale.
I like that card a lot. Fuck you.
I only bring this up because I don't know what it does, and I have a question.
Okay.
So the very first option is written very poorly, because I don't know if the creature can only have one power or toughness, or if it can have either and I choose.
It's either and you choose.
That's what I thought. That's what I think intuitively, but the wording isn't clear. It says, exile target creature with power or toughness one or less.
One of those things has to be true.
Okay.
You can exile a creature with power one or less, and you can exile a creature with toughness one or less.
So, for example, if you're looking at the newest spoilers page on Mythic Spoiler, it could exile the card next to it, Hedron Crawler. An 0-1.
Yes. Yes, it could.
Because of the 0 and because of the 1.
Yeah, sure. Sure, but what it says, with power or toughness one or less, it implies if both meet that condition, it can't happen.
More importantly, in your new fantastic Eldrazi
modern
deck,
I get what you're saying.
You can exile a Tarmogoyf.
If they play it that early.
I mean, seriously, for limited?
Just letting you know.
I'm going to put Warping Whale in my main board.
I am too. I mean, if I'm main colorless, absolutely, that sounds amazing.
What? Remember what you said about whaling the other day?
Yeah.
I just had that moment in reverse.
All right, so Paul and I have discovered that if you say the word whale out loud, your brain can't figure out you're saying it, you're reading W-A-I-L. It thinks you're saying W-H-A-L-E.
And do you remember what you were reading?
Yeah, it was some band.
Oh, yeah, the Wailers.
Yeah, the Wailers, and it was like, wait a minute, that's not what I meant to say, is it?
So when you said a warping whale, I was looking for a creature spell.
Maybe it's the me thing,
yes.
But...
A two-drop warping whale that just came to Zendikar on accident.
It's what saves Kiara.
And just went, oh, fuck.
No, it's one of those...
Shit's whack, yo! Shit's let's go!
Let's go, Kiara! Come on!
It's one of those intergalactic space whales from Dark Heresy.
Oh, not Star Trek 4?
I haven't seen that.
So, I noticed that we have a new creature here right next to Warping Whale.
Yeah, the goblin that's going to go in modern.
Called Hedron Crawler.
Oh.
What about it?
I noticed that it's a reference to an old card called Hedron Scrabbler.
There's another old card called Hedron something.
Looks more like a Hedron Crab to me, am I right? Am I right?
I mean, no.
It's a crab made of Hedrons.
It looks more like a spider.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. About it.
Another common way to make colorless mana.
Yeah, I mean, I think we mentioned it. We were saying Hedron Crawler and Seer's Lantern. I think colorless mana is going to be fine to cast. Endbringer is the only card I saw right now where it's like, maybe I'm not going to be able to use this to its full potential.
Do you remember how easy it was to splash colors when Mirror were around that did this? That's why, I think the colorless splash is going to be very easy. Especially if there's a common two-mana colorless producer like this, which there is.
Yeah, okay.
To be fair, it's a shit card otherwise.
Yeah, but if you're specifically trying to play your 5-drop with Trample...
Yeah, no, I agree.
That has functional Hexproof... Well, not Hexproof, but it's like functionally a Frost Giant.
I mean, they got a 2-for-1 themselves to get rid of it.
Right. So, I mean,
I think it's great.
Seems great.
So, guys, what you're saying is an 0-1 for 2 does not pass the vanilla test.
An 0-1 for 2 that taps for a...
Warping Whale.
Relatively constrained mana type.
Well, okay, I was talking to Paul about this before. I don't know how to evaluate the new colorless mana because the symbol's throwing me off. So, like, in a normal set, would you ever play this card?
Yes.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, probably.
Sometimes, yeah.
But I feel like I'm evaluating it differently because it has the symbol instead of just saying 1, like I'd be used to it saying.
Yes, I'm doing the same thing.
Like, I don't know. It's very confusing.
I don't know if I would see that any differently. Just look at it like, okay, so remember how when we were talking about the Moxes?
Yeah.
And you guys were saying you couldn't tell the difference between the Mox symbols on the new, like on Moto?
Sure.
Just looking at the artwork.
Just look at this and see it as a Mox symbol from across the room.
I'm not.
Look at it as like it looks like it just makes a mana.
Sure. I feel like I'm evaluating it too highly though, because it makes a hard to get kind of mana.
No. So, and that might be a mistake people are thinking if they're listening to this and they're going, oh, I want to put this in my deck. You should not put this in your deck unless you're specifically trying to cast colorless spells.
I don't know about that.
Or maybe just
it's also a ramper.
You know what? If it's looking
If you're sitting here and you're looking at a Hedron Crawler, and then you've got your Battle for Zendikar pack open, and you've got Kozilek Channeler in it, you're putting Kozilek Channeler in. You're not putting in Hedron Crawler.
I agree.
That's my evaluation.
But I can play my Kozilek Channeler on turn 4 after I play my Hedron Crawler.
Oh, okay, but it's important to remember that Kozilek Channeler now taps for this kind of mana. It just doesn't say that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I also, I mean, it's important to reiterate, when you're trying to ramp, for this card you're trying to get the 4 drops, right? A 2 mana ramp spell means you want to play your 4 drops on turn 3. This is something that was explained to me very early in my Magic playing life.
I do kind of like that imagery.
Right.
Yeah.
So you play this always if you have good 4 drops.
I'm going to note out that also spoiled today is maybe something I would see as a safer pick at common level for making colorless mana, which is Seer's Lantern. It's a 3 drop artifact that taps for colorless and has 2 tap scry 1. That's a card that I would be personally, because of my controlling habits, more likely to play than a 0/1.
It costs an additional mana. It's less fragile because it's not a creature.
But it has
the upside of scry.
It has the upside of scry in limited, which means when your deck is only at about 30 cards in it maximum, once you're starting to play these cards, probably more like 25, it gives you kind of a 1 in 25 chance. It makes your next draw so much better when you're scrying.
But Seer's Lantern can't block.
Neither can Hedron Crawler, let's be honest.
So, I don't want to go too deep on
Block a Tide Drifter.
Oath of the Gatewatch Limited.
No. So that's all I was saying there is that we have just seen just today 2 commons that are making the colorless. I don't think it's going to be hard to hit colorless, and you should probably play those spells. Was all I was trying to say.
Yeah, I think that will eventually be the consensus.
So, colorless creatures for Q. I like Endbringer a lot. I also like Kozilek, but I realize they're both a little hard to cast. Or a little hard to use. But I like them both for Q. I don't know what anybody else thinks about it.
I remain unmoved by Endbringer.
I fucking love it. I think it's the best thing ever, basically.
Kozilek seems pretty sweet, honestly. I like the idea of the card a lot.
Endbringer just does so much and ends up generating you so much value. The problem is you're not going to be able to capitalize on drawing 2 cards a turn because I doubt you have 4 colorless.
So, Kaz, I want to put something in comparison for you because I look at Endbringer and I see it as not so great.
Sure.
Endbringer to me looks like a killable Staff of Domination when I look at it. Staff of Domination sees almost no play already.
It sees a lot of play in Commander, but I guess that's not relevant.
But that's not the kind of thing you're trying to do in Cube.
Yes.
So what you're doing is you're playing, like, the deck that wants this that I could see playing it easily, in at least Paul's Cube, is the Artifact Big Ramp mana deck, right? It's not an artifact, though, which means it's not having any kind of synergy with the Library of Alexandria you're trying to rush it out with. And what it does is something that an artifact already does in that same slot.
What?
So what is the benefit? Like, for instance, having something like Staff of Domination.
I think this is better than Staff of Domination. Staff of Domination is way more expensive to use. This is a little more color restrictive in the sense of colorless restrictive. This also untaps every upkeep.
Side is that you get to tap it and deal 2 damage per turn. That's the big upside. Is that even if you got a blocker down?
I think being able to choose between a damage, a can't attack, a block, draw a card, like, and being able to do it twice a turn, I think that's
the can't
really
attack
great.
Or block this turn only applies to whatever other creature you spent mana to play, though. So the body on this creature doesn't matter because it doesn't untap before your attack step after it does that.
What?
It can prevent your opponent's creatures from attacking.
I think.
Correct, but the blocking portion on it is specific to other creatures you control. So the fact that this has a big body, which is 5/5 on it, doesn't matter. Like, it's not an unblockable creature, which is what I would look at this and want if I was seeing this. And that's not what it does.
It has, like, pseudo-vigilance in that it can attack and block. Which, vigilance is, I always feel, is a somewhat underrated ability, but it's also a very creature combat focused ability, which you can argue about how much creature combat matters.
I'm all for paying 2 to tap and draw a card literally twice a turn. That sounds fantastic. That's the best ability on this to me.
Yeah, I mean,
you can
agree.
Pay 4 in a turn and draw 2 cards continually. But at the same time, I don't want to pay 6 to do that initially because that means I'm paying 10 to draw 2 cards.
And you have a 5/5.
Yeah, I
don't look at 5/5.
I think this is so much.
It doesn't win me the game. It's not
this is so
for
versatile.
6, I could play a Grave Titan.
I mean, Grave Titan would be fucking amazing in the queue. Just say.
I could play a Primeval Titan then.
Also fucking amazing.
For 6, I could play Primeval Titan. For 6, I could play Baneslayer Angel and hold up Path to Exile.
and hold up Manitai.
Like, I don't know. It just, to me, it's not exciting, but
I mean,
that's my opinion of it.
I think part of what I'm looking at is, like, I like, what's the card? Icy Manipulator. Like, I love that card, honestly, in, like, a little more of a controlly deck. And this just seems so much better. I don't know. That's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I just, when I think of big game cards, I look at things like, and this is just my drafting style, is that looks like a finisher to me, and I only pick two or three of those when I'm drafting, and this is not one I'm taking. I would settle on this if I got it passed, like, in the last five picks of a pack, and I had not drafted any win strategies to my deck, but it doesn't look like something I want to take highly.
Yeah, I mean,
I would never open a pack and pick this second or third.
I mean, I wouldn't either. I still think the main problem is just the colorless requirements is a little much, but I don't know. And honestly, I'm a little biased because I'm just thinking of how amazing this would be in multiplayer card. It'd just be fucking stupid.
That's the context where I want to see.
Right. Multiplayer that gets to abuse the untap step portion is fantastic. I think this is a really great commander card.
Yeah, it is. Like, this is, like, pretty much a staple in, like, colorless commander decks. I don't see anybody not including it.
Right, I would agree with that evaluation.
So I'm a little biased.
I guess, let's go back to your second card for a minute. Kozilek the Great Distortion.
Yeah.
I like the design of this card. I'm biased in its favor. But I think the card it's competing with
is
a card that's going to be better than it most of the time. And that's Kozilek, the other one.
No, it's not. This card is competing. So in Modern now and in Standard, this card is competing specifically with Ulamog. And Ulamog controls the board better.
Well, I don't plan to put Ulamog in the queue.
Ulamog's too good. I think. Like, it's just, Ulamog's pretty fucking dumb.
If we're talking about having a space in the queue for a 10, like a colorless 10 drop, that you might...
I want the other Kozilek. I want to just draw 4 cards.
You don't want to draw up to 7 cards?
No. I want a solid draw 4.
With counter magic up?
With Annihilator.
You can't get old Kozilek into play on turn 2.
Yeah.
Not generally.
But then this just becomes a 12-12 with Menace. So I guess it still gets the countering thing. I mean, I agree. I kind of prefer the old Kozilek for Cube, but...
What hand are you protecting? So let's just... I'm just going to throw this out for the evaluation. The upside on this card... So let's say you drop 7. The upside for the protection on this card, because it's not indestructible, it doesn't have protection from anything, is that you can counter a spell by discarding a spell, right?
Yeah.
In your big mana deck that you're playing, what converted mana cost spells are you most likely to have in your hand once you draw?
I don't know. I would guess low numbers and high numbers.
I would guess mana dorks, 2-drop Cygnets that you haven't cast yet because you drew so many cards. You drew probably 3 lands when you drew up to 7. If you had nothing in your hand when you cast this,
yeah,
probably drew 3 lands, maybe drew 1 or 2 Cygnets, a mana dork, and maybe 1 3- or 4-drop spell. What kill spell are you countering to save this card?
They all cost 1 or 2.
That is, by and large, true. Removal spells cost 1 and 2 most often in the cube.
Spot removal.
Yeah.
Not like Wraths, which would also kill this. Although I guess if you got this in play on turn 2, you're not really worried about Wraths, because they're just going to die before they can cast them.
It doesn't have haste. It doesn't have Annihilator.
Yes, haste is what it needed to be absurd.
I wouldn't dislike it if it had haste.
I'm just saying, like, so this is going to get into today, but in last night's cube, I faced down a Kozilek that was cast and equipped to a Lightning Greaves,
yep,
and still won. And that was on turn 4.
Yeah.
And I won with a Pestermite.
So, I agree that I don't think
you say that
card,
like, it's an unusual thing.
When I brought this up, like I said, it's competing with the original Kozilek card. I like the original... I think the original Kozilek is generally more powerful. But I like the design of this card better because it's more interesting. And that's really what we're measuring. My interest versus the general notion that it's probably not as good.
I just love the Titans, so I'm all for just putting them in because I like seeing them. Sorry.
I will tell you, this moves me out of wanting to play the big mana deck, because I don't think my finisher can finish.
I guess there's an option where we play both Kozileks.
I mean, what, would you get rid of anything?
Well, I don't have to.
Just don't get rid of Sundering Titan, please. Why don't we put Blightsteel in the cube? That's fun.
No, it's not. Is Emrakul fun? Emrakul's fun.
I mean, yeah.
That is basically what you're saying.
I know. I knew what was what the response would be as soon as I said that.
Let's put Tinker in too.
Just for kicks, add all of the Moxon. maybe a Mind Twist.
Oh yeah.
A Time Twister, a few Storm cards. We're at Vintage Cube, yay!
Anything else that gets people's fancy? Like, I'm excited for Kalidas because I think the artwork's amazing, and I'm going to put in an Endrick Star Commander right away if I ever play Commander again.
I think far and away my favorite card in the set, which isn't to say I think it's the most powerful card in the set, because it's not.
Crush of Tentacles. Crush of Tentacles.
Jori and Ruin Diver. I love the design of this card. When I first read it, I just felt like I wanted to play it and see how I could draw spells with it. Both Unlimited.
Does it count? Oh, it doesn't count your opponents. I figured since it was going to be like...
Because people may not have it open right now.
So Jori and Ruin Diver costs one blue red for a legendary creature merfolk wizard. It has whenever you cast your second spell this turn, draw a card. And it's a 2/3. So I have a feeling people are going to mention this for Modern or something because it's a merfolk, and I don't care at all.
Yes, for Modern.
I just like that rules text. I actually love it. When I first read this card, I didn't even think of Surge at all, which I think is they designed it to interact with Surge cards, which is silly. In Standard, I don't know if this is very good because there's not that many like really cheap spells you want to be casting on the later turns in Standard. But the one play I think would be absolutely sick is like turn 4 you play Jorien and then you follow it up with a Tassigar, which you delve most of the cards for, which is the dream, you know, but...
Why is that particularly good?
I don't know.
Just because Tassigar is cheap?
Jorien into Tassigar and draw a card just for the rubbins. Seems great.
Seems fine. I mean, I don't have any...
It's kind of an innocuous card. It's really elegant design. I also really like the artwork on the Game Day Top 8 promo.
Oh.
But I liked the card before I saw that work. It only reinforced my existing
belief. What you're hitting on with this card is that it's not obscenely good, but the effect on it is going to be undervalued enough or fits directly into the area of very playable because it has an effect that people don't expect and or aren't able to evaluate and kill immediately. It's a 2/2. It's not the biggest threat when it hits the board. It doesn't need to immediately remove.
It's a 2/3, but yeah.
You're probably going to draw a card.
Yeah, I think you will end up drawing cards off of this, and then you'll maybe draw another card off of this, and you'll just slowly move forward. I want to put this card in the cube. I think at 9 of 10 cards right now. It's not the strongest section. It struggles for good multicolored cards. So there's no reason we can't put this in the cube. We're not cutting anything for it.
Sure. I don't think it's going to be particularly strong, but I guess I'm not fine with that.
I don't like Dak Faden.
His artwork sucks.
Yeah, it does. You got Ralzeric, though.
That's fine. It does what I want. The card that I look at if we're evaluating cards that we really like, that we think are going to be decent, or that we think are, you know, interesting, mine is Linvala the Preserver. I like this card for quite a few reasons, actually. One is the art, and two is the effect.
Linvala the Angel Preserver. Reinforcements.
Yeah, so it's a 6-drop, 5/5 with flying, which I like already. But the benefit of it is that if it enters the battlefield and your opponent has more life than you, you gain 5 life. So if you reanimate it, and you use literally the card reanimate and pay 6 life, you actually only pay 1, which is great to me. And 2, if they control more creatures than you control, you get a 3/3 white angel creature token on the battlefield also, which means it's an 8/8, or it's at least making 8 power and 8 toughness.
I do think one of the annoying things about this is that it's an angel, so Resto Angel can't flicker it.
That doesn't detract from it for me because of its legendary status, the fact that it looks to me like it's going to be a decent finisher and it does what I want it to do.
So, just for trivia, I've never seen the artist's name before, Magali Villeneuve or something like that.
Sure.
I'm sure it looks French or something. I'm sure I just pronounced it horribly. Also did two other cards you like a lot. Monastery Mentor and Narset.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. The reason that I was pointing out the art on it, though, which is why I think it's kind of cool, is that the angels on Zendikar, and I don't know how many people know this, but the angels on Zendikar usually wear their halos over their eyes, because
They were shamed by not recognizing Emeria, etc., as being the old, horrible Eldrazi that ravaged Zendikar thousands and thousands of years ago. And in this one, after they've all largely died on Zendikar, it shows that they're surging back and she's removed her halo to join the Force and fight against the Eldrazi. And I think that that's really cool that she's holding her halo up in the air saying, hey, we recognize that something is going on and we're going to help.
I will defeat you with my shame.
I didn't even notice that. Although I don't think she's wearing a halo in the
She's got it
original
in her left
art.
Hand. Oh, well, no. She doesn't in the original art. But like the rest of the angels from that set, if you look at things like Luminarch Ascension, all of the tokens, etc., those angels are wearing the halos in front of their eyes to show their shame for not realizing that Emeria, who ends up being Emrakul, was to show their shame for worshipping something that was actually relatively evil. Or at least evil in the sense that it was destroying Zendikar. So that's why I like this card. I want to reanimate it, I want to play this card, and it seems super cool. And even if I'm not reanimating it, it seems like a totally fine 6-drop to me.
Yeah, it does. I always like the card Timely Reinforcements. I feel like this makes that less special, which makes me a little annoyed with it, but I think eventually I'll settle on liking it for the same reasons.
I think that this is the kind of card that's going to go really well as a 1 or 2 of in a standard deck. I think this card's going to be expensive, is what I'm saying.
Does anyone have anything else they want to mention? Anything else about Oath of the Gatewatch?
How about Hedron Alignment?
Hedron Alignment for Cube.
Not for Cube, but...
For Cube.
The lulziest card ever that they've printed in this set. The Exodia of...
I actually like it a lot. I think it's hilarious.
This is either a really old card or a really old card design. I don't know which.
I just thought that it was very funny that they were printing a win the game card in the set.
I honestly thought it was kind of clever.
You know what it is though? It's just Search the City Reborn.
It's
the
hilarious.
Blue rare you don't want to open.
You don't want
there are
this.
Enough fucking dead cards in the rare slot with the Oaths and Hedron Alignment.
Do you really think the Oaths aren't playable?
In Limited?
You're playing
in Limited.
Hang on.
No.
In Limited.
No.
Let's say you open Inverter of Truth. And let's see how happy you are.
Dude, yeah. I would fucking play that card in Limited.
Yay, I opened a Mythic. I'm going to exile my entire library to play it.
Yeah, I'm still playing that. Nothing in Limited can stop this card. You're just
going
to win.
You're going to lose on your draw step.
So compare this to Ulamog, where you had to wait till the late game to play it, and what it did was really good. The difference is, this only costs 4 mana, so you're always going to be able to play it late. You just wait till there's some cards in your graveyard, and you have 5 or 6 turns. Nothing can kill this.
All you have to do to go all in with this card is wait till you have more cards in your graveyard than you need attack steps to win the game.
Right.
I think this card is so bad and people are going to lose games because they think it's good.
People are going to play it wrong, and they could have won if they had played it right.
With processors, I understand that it's possible to have cards in your graveyard, etc., but the fact that it is exiling, like returning cards from your graveyard, just scares me. This card worries me because of things that can get rid of things from graveyards, like Relic of Progenitus. I'm not saying that's in Limited, but I don't know what they're printing. This implies they're not going to print anything for it.
There's one card that can do that I can think of.
The one in...
It's called Grave
Birth
Things.
Yeah.
This is the Mythic Rare that I don't want to open.
I'm playing this in my deck.
I'm excited to open this.
I would think it'd be really cool, but...
You're certainly not casting... It looks really nice because it's got a converted mana cost 4. You are not playing this on your 4-drop.
Could be.
You have one card in your graveyard on your 4-drop. You want to have one draw step to win and deal 12 damage?
It wins the game in probably 2 turns. Maybe 3.
And it doesn't have haste.
No. I think playing it on turn 5 is fine.
Which means that you have to have 3 draw steps to attack. Which means you have to have 2 cards in your graveyard.
Yep.
And that's if your opponent was at 18.
Right.
And they had no blockers.
All of that is easily doable.
So no blockers.
They're not going to have blockers.
If they're blocking my creatures, then I'm getting more cards in my graveyard.
No, they just have to have a chump for this.
I guess that's
they're getting cards in their graveyard, not you.
But if they're blocking my creatures to get them to 18, like in my attacks that would put them to 18 life, then we're probably trading in the first few turns of the game.
Yeah, I don't know. I understand the excitement for this card that you guys have for it, but at the same time, this card is so heavy in. Like, you play it, they use their one removal spell that they have in their hand.
What removal spells kill this? I can think of two.
We haven't seen them.
Okay, from the last set. Because nothing so far now kills it.
Grip of Desolation.
I was not thinking of that one. Yeah, that does kill it. That costs six. I was thinking Stone Fury, which costs five, and Titan's Presence, which is really hard to use.
Stone Fury on six lands.
Now, Reflector Mage makes this look terrible.
Titan's Presence also, you'd have to get, like... Yeah, that would be pretty shitty.
But
I would love to get blown out like that. That sounds great.
Sounds hilarious. Yeah. Okay.
I just think, like, okay, so if you're looking at this at another Mythic Rare, if you play against a player that has Linvala in their deck, you're losing.
Yeah, but I think that's also true a lot of the time.
So for the Oaths, I'm going to say I would main Oath of Chandra. Clearly.
Yeah, you're playing all of them.
You're playing Oath of Gideon in
I'm
ally
not
strategy.
Playing Oath of Gideon.
You are if you have the green rally guys. Because then you get two ally figures, and those are the ones that stack.
You know, in allies, Oath of Gideon seems fine, but it's not a rare that you'd always just put in your deck.
But you shouldn't
but allies,
many rares are.
Ally decks are going to be available in every, like, 8-man pod, though, of draft. Or some number of sealed pools. Like, this card just, boom, is finished.
Imagine if you play this, amazing in an wouldn't I rather make that other ally creature creator that you got from Battle from Zendikar?
The Retreat to Emyria?
I mean,
no.
I would rather play Retreat to Emyria than Oath of Gideon.
The Converge one.
Retreat to Emyria requires you to wait.
I'd rather play the Converge one.
So, one of the best decks in this format is White-Black Life. White, like, Orzhov, basically.
Oh, yeah, the Drain version of allies.
Yeah, and those cards synergize with Oath of Gideon, because you would get two Colossal Healer triggers, and then that can stack. I think you shouldn't be disappointed to open this card, but it's never going to win you the game. It's never going to win you the game on its own, but it's not terrible.
Well, if we're going to continue, Oath of Jace is shit.
Is Rally on any cards?
Oath of Nissa is the most mediocre thing to put in your, like, limited deck. Oath of Nissa is not a great card for limited.
We don't know if Rally is even in this set.
The Eldrazi don't have a mechanic. Have you noticed that? Their only mechanic is the new mana symbol. It's the stupidest fucking thing I've ever seen in my life. I hate this set. It's terrible. But anyway, I'm still excited to play with it. What were we talking about? Oh yeah, Oath of Jace. So, do you remember Enhanced Awareness from Fate Reforged?
No.
That was 5 mana for draw 3, discard 1, I think.
Yeah.
Might have been discard 2, but I'm pretty sure it was discard 1.
I remember
1.
It not being very good.
Okay, it was amazing. Everybody wanted that card in draft. Ed loved that card at the pre-release.
You know when Oath of Jace is good?
Enhanced Awareness?
Yeah, we like Enhanced Awareness. Oath of Jace is really good when I have one really good card in my deck.
Sure.
It's still fine the rest of the time.
Yeah.
You can say that about
what it's good
spell.
With? Whatever
that's,
the Japanese
that's why
card
draw spells are good, even if they don't plus your cards.
Except in most limited environments, draw spells aren't particularly great. Like, they're okay. They're not exciting. It's not something I'm happy to open in a rare slot, unless it's like some super draw, like that Ugin's Insight.
I would much rather open a rare I play in every blue deck than a rare I don't play.
How many rares are you not going to play? As long as it's in your color, most rares are playable.
I don't know. Sometimes I feel
more playable than Oath of Jace. Oath of Jace feels like an uncommon if you're not getting the Planeswalker shit. And it feels like you're losing.
Uncommons are usually better than rares. But
I completely disagree.
Uncommons are designed for limited. Rares aren't necessarily.
Many of these rares are still amazing in limited.
I generally find that when I play a sealed pool, I will play 2 to 3, if I'm lucky, 4 of my rares in my deck.
That's a lot. The other rares you're not playing are probably because they're not in your color.
It's not because they're not in my color. It's because either, one, they don't do anything, because I got something like Search the City.
Then how many colors are you playing to have to be able to play 4 of your rares and the other 2 just not be in your color? You're just playing 5 color?
I generally will play more colors unsealed than other people. But at the same time, like I said, I was playing like 2 to 4 of my rares. You want to play more of your uncommons than you
can
play
go,
rares.
I can go through this.
I would put Oath of Gideon in a deck.
I can go
point.
Through all of these rares if you want, and I'll say how many of them I play in limited deck, but that'd be kind of pointless.
I would put Oath
it would
of Gideon
be
in
at
my
least
deck.
3/4 of them, and they would all be more exciting than Oath of Jace.
Sure. There's always cards you're more excited to play.
I mean, that's my argument, is that these, like, yeah, they're not dead cards.
Sure.
But, like, it's still eating up rare slots,
okay.
Which I'd much rather be getting something else.
It could be
it
a dead card.
Me. Because it's mainly made for Constructed.
Could be a Defiant Bloodlord and be completely useless. but it's not. It's always going to be playable if you're in that color. And I'm fine with that. I don't care.
Oath of Gideon isn't always playable if you're
when
in that
you're
color.
When you're playing... Okay, sure. That's the only one that's complete. That's maybe unplayable.
You know, it's probably a C-minus no matter what.
When I'm playing sealed, rares are just like other cards. They don't need to be special to me.
But that's especially, not how it works. Because...
All right.
Like, you could still... They don't have to be special, but there's still going to be that player who opens up a better rare than
okay,
you.
Sure.
Which is 75% of the other rares.
Stick with
it's
me
getting
here.
A better deal.
Stick with me here. This is not a format, at least... Battle for Zendikar, sealed and limited, was not a format based on bombs. It was based on synergy. And that's part of the reason I find it so difficult to draft. I don't see a reason that it's going to change that much. So, in a heavily synergy-based format, the rares aren't the bombs that they appear to be on paper. So, I would rather have four Colostria healers and two Drawn as Emissaries than the three Drowner of Hopes, just because I know that's going to do better.
Right.
Because I've seen how the format has played out.
The thing that I distinctly remember when we were playing Battle for Zendikar, at least sealed, when we were starting for pre-release day, and I played both days and every event over the weekend, was at the first two events... People had no idea what they were doing because we were coming off of a set where you could play all of your rares. So being knowledgeable looking at this set and saying, hey, this is a playable card and I can play two colors solidly, maybe splash a colorless, is how you need to look at these cards. And I think it's as a three drop that makes two bodies, I think that's totally fine.
I've reached a point in my Magic playing career where opening rares is not exciting.
No, you want to look at the rest of the cards.
Opening it's, money, or maybe opening, like, a Planeswalker still may have a little spark of excitement.
You guys are, like, missing the point, though. Like, that's not my argument.
What's your point?
Just what I said. They're just lackluster rares compared to most of the other rares in the set.
Well, you said they were all shit.
What?
You said all of the rares were shit.
All
I know, because I'm
shit.
Being melodramatic, because that's what everybody does.
Well, yeah, sure. Hyperbole aside, like, I get your point. I just don't think this is the format where that's worth complaining about, because you're not just going to lose. I mean, if you want to open cool rares, fine, but that's true of every set. And you're always, there's always
new
cards
that don't want to open cool rares. I want to open things for limited.
Sure.
These seem like passable, but in terms of a rare, I'd rather get other cards. That's what I'm saying.
Do you know what the most annoying card was during Battle for Zendikar? Sealed? Bane of Balajed. Every person had a Bane of Balajed.
It's a funny way to say Colostria Healer.
Every person had a Bane of Balajed, and it essentially had Annihilator, and it was the most obnoxious card.
You know what's worse than Bane of Balajed? All of these oaths. But that doesn't change my argument.
I would rather everyone has oaths than Bane of Balajed.
Bane of Balajed's an uncommon.
Just saying.
We know.
I'd much rather
okay.
Bane of Balajed.
Okay.
Whatever.
Here's my... I don't think rarity should be the thing you're complaining about, because there are commons and uncommons that are better than almost all the rares.
But that's not really what I'm complaining about.
I don't understand what you're complaining about.
It is sort of what I'm complaining about, but it's more of, like, compared...
It's not a Call the Gate Watch.
Yeah, I know, that's a shit card. I'm gonna hate when that gets open.
Like,
yeah,
you open
okay.
Call the Gate Watch, and you lost a rare.
I agree, the oaths aren't as bad as I'm probably making them seem.
Sure.
I'm just talking in terms of relative. I'm only talking about limited.
Yeah.
And in terms of just relative to other rares in the set, they're not exciting for me to open. They're not. There's not something I really am excited for in limited.
Sure,
like,
but
it's just,
I'll put this with
that's
it.
All
I don't...
I'm saying. Like,
okay.
A lot of other sets, like it to me, like I wouldn't be fine with a few of these, but having four oaths, four rares. That I just like, or like, what? Like, that's a lot of cards that all of a sudden I just don't care about.
Sure, but I don't see how the potential in this set is any higher than other sets to open rares you don't care about. Or, like, do you think that the oaths of these characters should be better for limited? Based on whatever it's called.
I think it's eating up too many card slots for
okay.
an effect that I don't give a shit about. And I guess that's biased.
In a small set, you might have a point. Because this is a small set. I don't know. I think they all seem fine.
Super Friends can suck it.
Sure. Well, you're just never going to get Planeswalkers.
I mean, we haven't probably mentioned the one that's best in limited either.
Oath of Chandra.
Also has the best
Chandra
player attack.
Because... Because I admitted already that I would main Oath of Chandra. It's just a 3-damage spell. It's fine with me for 2. I'll
Gold
do it.
Lightning Strike. If it means that people can live in freedom, yeah, I'll keep watch.
Fucking Chandra.
Man, your card is so bad.
Gideon and Jace have no personality at all, and Chandra's, like, way too casual about what's happening.
Jace's flavor text doesn't make any sense for his character either.
I know.
That's because I've mixed this almost murdered him.
For the sake of the multiverse, I'll keep watch. Jace doesn't care about the multiverse.
Did you read that, Ed? The thing where just Obnixilus goes on, like, killing spree.
No, Goodspeed was telling me about the rampage he went on, and I wish that Obnixilus had one, and it said, for the sake of the multiverse, I'll kill them all. Because this is just, like, Jace does not care about the multiverse. His character never has in any of the story, and all of a sudden he just makes this oath.
Yeah, whatever.
The Planeswalker cast are all shitty caricatures, and they're not very interesting.
Like,
in
I understand Gideon's. He's this weird guy that went to this plane that's all like, hey, people dying on this plane, I'm gonna be a defender here and never go back to my plane again, because, let's be honest, it was terrible.
What's the best? Get out of here. It recently beat Zendikar in a poll.
That's stupid. That poll is rigged.
There is no way that Theros beat
that's
Zendikar.
That's stupid.
Did it? I don't remember.
Oh, I think it was up against... Not Zendikar, no.
Paul sent me a picture on New Year's Day that said, what do I vote for? And I had already voted by the time he had a red receipt. So I didn't know what it was until he told me. But we obviously voted for Theros.
So Mark Rosewood has been doing a daily poll on his Twitter where he does these brackets of different things. He did evergreen keywords, and now he's doing planes. And what I found, I'm glad flying won the evergreen keywords, because it really is the best keyword for the game.
It's not. It's certainly no horsemanship.
I don't think horsemanship was allowed. It was evergreen, so definitely not. It beat Flash by, like, just a narrow margin.
Did you see that Tarkir ended up losing to Alara?
Yeah, I did see that.
It's sad. Anyway.
So this is a comment that I made, and then you made again. But basically, both Tarkir and Alara were more interesting in the first set of their blocks than in the last set of their blocks. We left the plane in a much less interesting place than we started.
Yep.
With megamorphs.
Isn't that true of Innistrad as well?
Innistrad's fucking cool. I
know.
Are you kidding?
I hated the cards in that
Addison
set.
Addison Restored was stupid.
But retroactively looking at the flavor of that set, I am all in for the return.
Addison Restored was just angels.
Is Innistrad really significantly different than it was? Like, it didn't change much. Not the way that Alara and Tarkir
no,
changed.
No, it changed a hell of a lot.
I don't know.
It shifted from being the Evernight plane to being the Everdawn plane. Like, that's a big shift.
That's
going to
be the Evernight plane again.
Avacyn coming back was a huge shift for it. Something, before we get off too far from the oaths that I wanted to talk about that I thought was really cool looking at the artwork of these pictures...
I mean, I'm done with oaths, so you can just...
...is that each of the Planeswalkers seems to have a symbol that we have not seen before.
I'm not sure if it's the Planeswalkers or just the colors of magic manifest differently.
I don't know if that's what it is either, but the implication is kind of cool.
Well, Chandra is just the set symbol. And by Chandra, I meant Nyssa.
Nyssa isn't the set symbol at all.
This is.
No, hers is like three little triangles inside of a circle with more triangles around
it. The set symbol is Kozilek's
crown. They're very similar.
No.
They're very similar.
Kaz has a point.
What'd you say? I understand that.
Kozilek's crown.
I understand that, but Nyssa's symbol looks just like it to me.
Symbol is actually people high-fiving because it's an oath.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the guy.
Get it? It works both ways.
That was a joke.
I don't get it.
No, it's probably intentional.
No, but I think it's kind of cool that you
what
can
is
see.
Oath of, yeah, what are these symbols? What is Oath of
I don't know
Jace?
What they are.
Like, what the fuck is that?
That's why
it matches the runes on his cloak in the very many pieces of artwork with him.
They're just kind of interesting.
Oh, so there's going to be some secret backstory with Jace about how he was, I don't know.
Raped by a sphinx again?
Yes. Mind raped by a sphinx.
Maybe that's his thing. Maybe he's here to meet the Sphinx of the Final Word and let him have the final word.
The reason he can't remember any of his past is because he's had too many problems and traumas.
Alright. Do you want to talk about the reserve list?
The reserve list?
We'll put a link to the article I'm talking about in the link dump. But when I first heard of the reserve list, I was like, that's just greedy bullshit. They just want money.
What's a reserve list?
And everyone was like, no, it's good for the game. So the reserve list is just a list of cards they'll never reprint.
Well, it's not good for the game. It's good for the people who have the cards.
Sure,
that's the reason they
sure.
did it, is to keep value.
It doesn't even give Wizards money at this point.
Okay, but that's the point of this article, is yeah, it does.
Really?
Well, this is an article about a former Wizards employee who was caught stealing some ridiculous amount of dollars worth of cards from an alleged vault that Wizards of the Coast has, full of promos and rares that are on the reserve list. So
what?
Right. When I read about that, I'm just like, okay, this only exists because they like money.
They're just hoarding them. For...
Right.
They're hoarding stock and they're monopolizing it, and they can release them at any point to gain money into the market, unknown to everyone else.
This is a tinfoil hat conspiracy.
This
theory.
Is. The vault isn't. The vault is real.
Yeah, but does it have an amount of cards that would actually make a meaningful difference in the supply compared to the demand?
No. That's not the point. The point isn't to make a difference in the supply. It's that at any time, whoever has control of the vault can sell a specific single card month by month to gain wizard profit. So let's say they have a Black Lotus to get rid of every 2 months, and they gain $10,000 every 2 months.
Except they've never done that.
Right. There's no evidence that they're doing that, but the idea of them owning a vault makes the idea of the reserve list seem really sketchy to me.
To the best of my knowledge, in the original Zendikar block, when they had the treasure hunting theme...
Sure.
They would put super old cards into regular booster packs, and they were called treasured finds.
Okay.
And that is what the expeditions are a callback to.
Yeah.
So they were just giving them away in regular booster packs in small numbers.
Sure, but they weren't just giving them away. It was a way to increase their profits because they were worried the set wouldn't sell otherwise.
Except they didn't tell anybody about it at that time.
And that doesn't make sense to me. I don't believe you.
they just didn't tell anybody about it. The expeditions were announced way, like, right at the beginning of the set was announced.
Right.
Expeditions are stupid.
Expeditions are also really weird in the fact that they are another printing of a card that had fewer cards of it that not only increased in price themselves, but increased the price of the other card.
Expeditions is Wizards saying, look, I know
which
this
is just
is.
So backwards because supply went up.
Is that true?
Yeah. It's the Giffen good.
And why is it true? Like, what was the cause?
Because people suddenly got these cards who were standard players and decided they should make a deck around them.
So you're saying that it pulled people into Modern and Legacy?
Yes.
Okay. That's true about every time they print cards, like Modern Masters too, though.
Sure.
The original Modern Masters mainly made Modern card prices increase, with like, a handful of exceptions.
You're giving people something that's rare and shiny, and saying that they have one specific one, and they're not going to sell it, because they're greedy little cheapmongers, and they just want to go, I want three more of these so I can play a deck with this in it.
See, if I had one of these cards, and I wanted four of them, I would just sell it.
I would sell it for four of the normal kind.
If I opened one of these, and I never will, and I could put it in the cube, like if it was a card I already had in the cube, I probably would consider it. Especially if it's one of the one-of cards, not the ones that come in a set, because I generally like match sets more than... like promos.
Like Wasteland.
Even though, like, some of those filter lines are pretty awesome looking. Like, Cascade Bluffs is cool as hell. Sunken Ruins is amazing artwork.
The only filter land I have that I would replace would be Graven Cairns, because I have the Future Sight Graven Cairns and not the other four ally colored filter lands in the cube. And I would definitely keep the Future Sight one, because it has way cooler artwork than they'll ever print on that card ever again.
I don't know.
So on these expeditions, like these new ones, I think it's something that they really missed out on. Like, I understand them wanting to print the double color ones here, but I think that by going through and printing these other, like, Mana Confluence, etc., Eye of Ugin, they really missed out on the ability to make the manlands again and make them pretty. Like, they just printed a new cycle of manlands and they did nothing with it. They could have easily done Shambling Vent.
They did. Did they not do Shambling Vent in the last set?
No.
They could have done. Ooh. They could have done expeditions for them.
Right.
Because there's a cycle of 10 of them now, and they should have just done all 10.
I like their decision to reprint lands that make colorless mana because it reinforces like the core thing about the set.
But that doesn't make any sense because it's a separate set.
This is a flavor argument, and I know that this is not tied to flavor. It just won't be because the design space is too big.
Like I understand. Putting in, like, modern staples, like Forbidden Orchard, because that increases people want to play these cards. But something that's played more than any of these cards in most decks are manlands.
Horizon Canopy.
Core Haven?
Oh, come on, that one is Zendikar-themed, for all intents and purposes. If your argument is that it should have been something flavorful, this is not the antithesis to your argument.
No, I didn't say that it should be something flavorful. I'm saying that they missed the opportunity to print cards that would have gotten people into the market that they're trying to sell these cards for.
Like your argument that these cards were out of flavor then. then this is not the right
I was never to. Arguing flavor. I was arguing that they printed flavor cards rather than printing things that would have been useful or exciting.
I would be super excited to open one of these.
You just think it's a missed opportunity, right?
I think it's a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not super excited.
Now that they've introduced the idea of expeditions, they can do this as much as they want to.
Oh my god.
Well,
let's pretend that this will be limited to this block.
Sure.
That could happen.
Let's give everyone a pipe dream of opening this really sweet mythic foil and get everyone to buy like 20 fucking packs for nothing and open a bunch of shit.
It's because this set had no reason for people to buy more packs continually.
That's what I think.
That's why they put these in it.
I mean, it's really easy to come to that conclusion, but I think that's... If it's partially true, it's not the whole truth.
No, it is, because you're coming off of a marketing set where you could open fetch lands.
Okay, let me present an idea. So, Concept Art Hero Block, awesome, has fetch lands. Cards are really powerful and fun to play with. They know, when they're designing these sets at least 2 years in advance, which sets need to be powerful and not powerful in order so that power creep doesn't take over the game. So, they look, Cons was really good, they need to print a underpowered set, and so they just put Zendikar and put it there because they know that it's underpowered while also having the expeditions.
I'm not saying it's untrue. I'm just saying it's not the entire truth.
Sure, but what I'm saying is I think they would have designed them together and then fit them into the schedule where it worked best. Which is disappointing because I don't ever want a set to be underpowered.
I mean, you have to look at it as it's a company and the company is trying to increase their profits. The way they increase their profit on a set that's doing shitty is to put something, or that they project is going to sell shittily, is to put something exciting in it.
Well,
like these.
And what I'm saying is they didn't design it that way. They didn't design it and think, oh no, this isn't going to sell. They said, we're going to do this. This is what we're going to do. We're going to make it underpowered and put expeditions in it. The decision was made at the same time. It was not, oh no, we need to make this sell better. The decision was made before design started.
I mean, regardless of when that decision was made, that was the idea when they were going into it. But
right.
The expeditions were something that was going to sell the packs.
Yeah.
Again, you're simplifying it to a single argument when you don't have to. You can just say that's part of the truth.
Sure.
Why do you want this to be the exclusive truth?
Well, what's the other part of the truth?
That it's a callback to the treasured finds from the original Zendikar block.
Why do they make one out of 100?
Because it's a callback to the original treasured finds of Zendikar block.
Haven't they done that in supplementary products instead of making a 1 out of 100 super foil chance?
But we're going back to
like...
Zendikar. It's like a direct connection.
Yeah,
and
you can release a supplementary product right next to the Zendikar block or Zendikar packs, and it'd be the same effect.
Except that the treasured finds came in Zendikar packs.
On your flavor argument, where you're saying that this is all super flavorful, can you explain how when the entire planet...
No, I'm saying it was super mechanical.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say, like, can you explain how if we're exploring Zendikar and it's all being eaten by Eldrazi, how we're finding new landforms instead of waste? This would be something that I would expect in the let's go to Zendikar the first time when it's not being eaten by Eldrazi. Because, like, the land is growing and flourishing and it's doing well.
Well, what they're establishing...
But instead, we're getting this area where there are, like, hundreds of new landforms that aren't just the basic lands on this planet. On this plane.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah. Because in the lands that are colored, we have man lands, which are not just the basic lands of this planet either. There's no reason to say that they're both colorless and, like, lands that produce colorless and lands that produce colored mana would behave differently in their occasional rare specialization.
Wastes don't imply a lack of complexity or depth. They just tap for colorless. So any land that taps for colorless fits in with the wastes theme, is I think how the logic works.
Okay, I see that. I mean, Mana Confluence doesn't do that, but I see.
Sure.
That.
Yeah, Mana Confluence doesn't make sense in this list.
Neither does Forbidden Ocean. I mean, let's just keep pointing them out.
Yeah. So, I guess I would agree. I would prefer that all of these make colorless mana in some capacity. Or are like Eye of Ugin, which is flavor, like, is just a land for Zendikar.
Isn't that card, like, spiked in price this week?
You should also point out that the two cards we've mentioned are also gold instead of the normal color.
The ones that make colored mana have a gold frame, whereas the ones that make colorless... have a subdued frame. Regular lands do this too.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Sucking runes.
It just makes them fit less in this idea.
It's misleading. It implies lands are colored.
No, it doesn't. It just means
right.
Okay, yes, it does.
Yeah.
So it's only like the 5 colors.
I don't know.
It's like a gold frame.
I recognize that the coloring of the text box and the little fine line that separates the card border from the card art and stuff does change from different types of lands.
You know what they should have reprinted? Mishra's Factory.
Generates colorless mana.
That's artifact affiliated.
That would also be worth thousands of dollars.
I should have reprinted Library of Alexandria, but that's on the reserved list.
Eye of Ugin doesn't generate colorless either.
Yeah, but like I said, it fits with the artwork.
It does not generate colorless. You cannot say it taps for colorless. It
I
does
didn't.
Not.
No,
for it
nobody
to,
said
I'm,
that.
I'm saying to Goodspeed.
Goodspeed.
For it to
going.
Tap for anything, you need to have literally
Org. Yeah, I know.
I'm hoping you open Wasteland so we can get Wasteland. We have a Wasteland and Strip Mine? That sounds like fun.
We have a Wasteland, and it's a special one.
Do we
have a Strip Mine?
Don't we have the... Didn't you get the Gold Wasteland? Did you not put it in?
I don't like it.
Oh, okay.
I don't like the gold border, and I took it out.
But
I also put in Strip Mine at the same time, because
okay.
I do like Strip Mine.
No, I didn't know that wasn't in. I just was not paying attention. I don't like that Wasteland looks like it's got the Oblivion Stone Hedron up at the top of it. And also looks like it's a river and some dark rocks.
Yeah,
that makes me think that it's blue-black.
It does just look like a river to me.
But it's not.
Weird. I like the other Wasteland where it's like a castle falling into like a giant sand pit. I thought that was really fucking cool.
Like, I would rather have the Dust Bowl art on Wasteland and then have a completely different art for Dust Bowl.
Yeah, in general.
I'm hypercritical. I'm sorry.
I think we all are.
That's fine.
Do you like how Corehaven...
I love how Sunken Ruins has Gomazoas on it. I thought they were dead.
We have yet to see a Gomazoa in any other context.
Yeah, why haven't we seen those?
I really want some.
There was like a post on Morrow's blog or his Twitter or something, or maybe it was on the Wizards website. I'm remembering this from like a shadow of memory. Oh, I know what it was. Okay. They posted a video where they had this Asian guy take over Morrow's responsibilities for like answering questions on Tumblr for a day. And they like video. It was like a video though on YouTube. And somebody asked in Tumblr, why aren't there any Gomazoas? What happened to them? And so he, like, runs around the wizard's office talking to people in the video. He's like, do you know about this? Do you know about this? And he, like, walks into a room with two guys, and they're doing things that are, like, jokes. They're talking about, like, future sets, but they're not telling the truth, presumably, or something. I don't remember what the jokes were, but... At the end of the video, it was implied, at the very least, that the Gomazoas are all dead, or something.
So it sounds like design team forgot Gomazoas existed, and then they retroactively went, hey guys, let's just tell them they died. I'm fine with them saying certain things are extinct, except for the fact that they just said angels weren't, and we thought they were.
So who wants to talk about Cube this week?
Sure. Shall we talk Dex first, or Goodspeed Squalms?
Yeah, give me 2 to 5 minutes about what your deck was and how you did.
I'll start. I had the most fun deck since my Stax deck. I was super excited about it. This is like one of the first decks. After I got done playing, I'm just like, I just want to keep playing with this deck because it's super fun. It does just so many things. It's Abzan. How did drafting go? So I think the first pick, was a Feomancer because I can't pass that card ever. This is why I'm always in black. You guys are just like, a Feomancer pack rat, fuck those cards. I'm like, what are you guys talking about? And so, you know, I'm in black. I don't know, I got a Feomancer. I don't remember exactly how the rest of it went. I started right from the beginning in Abzan. Was Siege Rhino in the first pack? I think it was.
Siege Rhino was in the first pack.
And so, like, I took Siege Rhino, and I'm just like, I don't even have the lands to do this yet, but I'm just gonna force it. I just ended up taking a bunch of good cards.
That's really funny, because I honestly considered forcing Abzan when I saw Siege Rhino, and then I was like...
Well, I'm glad we both didn't try for that, because both our decks would suck. But yeah, so, I mean, I ended up with, like, Mana Dork, so Avacyn's Pilgrim and Elves of Deep Shadow, and enough dual lands that, like, I was actually pretty comfortable playing Abzan. There's just so many synergies. Like, it turned into, like, creating tokens, and then also Flicker and ETB effects, and then also, like, a bit of stacks, and then also some aggro. And it just ended up, like, together. Like, it was really good. So, like I said, I have the Mana Dorks early. I have, like, Nest Invader. I have, like, Blood Artist, Kitchen Finks, which just, like, work with, like, my creatures dying or just having tokens. I have Braids. And, like, I generate tokens with, like I said, Nest Invader. I have Voice Resurgence, which generates tokens or just acts as, like, I have two creatures out of it. Yeah, that was the other thing. So, like, all of my creatures, all of my spells just, like, generate so much advantage. Well, it's just with everybody, especially against... I noticed it more against Paul, where it's just, like, Paul was had so much, like, removal. Like, he was still, like, just barely able. Because it's, like, every time he just wiped the board, I would repopulate the entire board with, like, one card. And then it's just, like, okay, I'm back in control of the game.
I think your comments are a little misleading, because I didn't ever wipe the board. I just recurred my cards enough times to trade resources with you.
Deranged Hermit was amazing. He just comes down and puts 7 power on the board. That's great. Wait, it's more than that, isn't it? It's 9 power.
That's correct.
9 power.
It's like a precursor golem, but different.
And, like, and then I Master the Wild Hunt. Just a bunch of stuff that, like, made tokens. But then I had Vengevine, too, which I guess comes back from the graveyard. And so, like, in that way, it kind of works with the synergies. And then I have, like, Deathrite Shaman and Blood Artist, which both kind of work with, like, draining without having to interact with the opponent. The same with Braids. It's like, I don't really have to interact with the opponent that much. I can just make tokens and sacrifice them and force the opponent to sacrifice shit. But then I also have, like, Restoration Angel and a bunch of cards that work with Restoration Angel, like Siege Rhino. I have Eternal Witness to get stuff back from my graveyard. Once again, just be like, I have one card that's just, like, I'm constantly 2-for-1-ing people, in a sense. Or just having so much value. And I just have good cards like Gideon and Vraska, and I had Flesh Carver too, which is like, let me sacrifice all the tokens to like make some like basically unblockable threat. I just feel like my deck has so many different synergies with each other and just works so well together.
You certainly were able to deploy a lot of permanents.
Yeah.
Like, just the number of permanents you could have in play, or you would get over the course of the game, would easily be 1.5-2 times what other people were doing.
Yeah, I had Blade Splicer 2, Arresto Angel that, and, like, made... I was able to, like, kill a 6-6 without losing any of my shit. Because I blocked with 2 First Striker Golems. Like, I don't know, this is just, like, pure value. Oh, and then I have Elesh Norn, which just came in and just, like, oh my god. Except it didn't win the game against Ed, which is frustrating. But,
As I recall, Ed didn't have many creatures in his deck.
Yeah, that's true. The Elesh Norn just, like, comes down and, like, makes a lot of the games I was just hoping to get Elesh Norn, like, I'd win. Especially with, like, fucking Deranged Hermit. Elesh Norn sounds devastating.
So let's talk about the games you and I played.
Okay.
I'll go with my deck really quick. I was playing, like, a Grixis control deck that was very heavy on recursion. I had a whole lot of 1, 2, and 3 drops. I was using Snapcaster Mage and Jace Friend's Prodigy to recur the spells. I was using Nozomi Grave Robber and Liliana to recur the creatures. And I was using Yawgmoth's Will to recur everything.
And Snapcaster Mage to recur the Yawgmoth's Will to recur everything else.
So let's talk about that. You had an Eldrazi spawn token in play, and you cast a Deranged Hermit. And I was at, like, 9 life, and I was really far behind on board at that point.
Yeah.
But I had a turn where I had 10 mana, because I was pretty flooded, and Kaz was on, like, 6 at this point, I think. I Snapcaster Yawgmoth's Will. Off the Yawgmoth's Will, I discarded it to something. I forget what. But off
your own Liliana.
Yeah, that was it. I Snapcaster Yawgmoth's Will. I used Yawgmoth's Will to bring back Liliana from the graveyard. And then I used my last 2 mana to evoke Shriekmaw, killing the Deranged Hermit, which is essentially killing 5 power. Deranged Hermit dies because I evoked it. Liliana flips. I get a zombie token, and then I bring back Nozomi Grave Robber with Liliana that turn, which eventually ends up flipping.
Just reanimates everything. The fucking Nozomi Grave Robber. It's so good. I love that card.
Slaughter Pact is awesome with Yawgmoth's Will.
I know. Slaughter Pact is just an amazing card. I love it.
I didn't think it would be as good as I've seen it play, but I hadn't played with it before. It's one of those cases where, like, I heard it's good. I see it do things sometimes, but it's actually, like, so exciting suddenly.
Oh, no, I know. Like, I remember when I was playing with that blue-black deck last time, like, Slaughter Pact is my favorite card.
There's so many turns where I needed to be able to play, like, something to aim a Slaughter Pact, and then be able to pay for the pact sometime later. But then I could, like, flash it back and not pay its cost again that same turn, so... It compounded really well with all the things I was doing.
This deck was just so interesting. It had so many moving pieces, and all of my games against all of you guys were, like, incredibly close. Like, it was super fun this week. I had a ton of fun. This is the most fun I've had in Cube in a while. I don't know, I remember against Goodspeed, I, like, stabilized, like, 1 life.
At 1 life by ultimate pricing his Kitchen Finks with a lethal Grim Lavamancer on the stack.
Yes. Oh.
That's disgusting. I love it. But in both our games, you got ahead of me on board, and I got down to about 5 life. And I just eked out enough value recurring things over and over. Like, I put you in a position...
Reanimated my Siege Rhino.
Yeah. So you attacked me with Siege Rhino because you were trying to close out the game. But I brought back something at instant speed off of whatever Nozomi Grave Robber becomes.
Night Eyes the Desecrator.
Sure.
That's right.
That sounds right. So Night Eyes brought back something, and then I triple blocked Siege Rhino to kill it and take no damage. And then Siege Rhino was in the graveyard. And so I brought back Siege Rhino, and something that I was at a comfortable spot where even though you had a 6-6, you either had to block Siege Rhino and it died, and I would just recur it again.
Yeah.
or you wouldn't block it and you would just take damage off the Siege Runner directly. And I think that's really how that game was able to end.
Every card in this deck is good. Flesh Carver in particular just really impressed me. I always thought it was kind of a meh card in Cube, but just like, I so much crap to sacrifice, and the fact that it just replaces itself when it dies is really good.
Yeah, I had a positive experience the one time I played with that card too. Same impression going in, like, I don't know, it doesn't seem that good, maybe yeah. It's okay. Dude loves to kill planeswalkers.
Yeah.
The Intimidate's very solid. The ability to sacrifice things makes blocking really hard for your opponents occasionally. I don't know if there's a whole lot more to say about your deck other than it was very good at what it was doing. The only other thing I want to say about my deck is that you can play Jace Friends Prodigy, Jace Beller, and Jace the Mind Sculptor in the same deck, and it works out okay.
I think I advocated this once before, except it was Jace and Ashiok, so.
Yeah, but like I was concerned that having too many Planeswalker-Jace would make them stuck in my hand or something. But in practice, I usually ended up just minusing whichever variant I had in play for some value, and then playing the next one. Or, like, tempting my opponents into attacking them when I didn't need them around anymore.
Yeah, see, the really great thing about having the backup Jaces, and this is something that I learned kind of in Standard when I was playing 4 Jace Brim's Prodigy, because you inevitably, in multiple games, will have one or two of them, is that a lot of, at least Brim's Prodigy specifically, says, it's a lot like Raphelos, which means it says on the card, what I like to call it, the first one, casting it, is actually just, instead of saying that it's a planeswalker that's a merfolk looter, is instead that Jace Friend's Prodigy actually says opponent discards a removal spell. So you pay one and a blue, and it's kind of like paying a black. So I always look at Jace Friend's Prodigy that way, and then having the upside of giving your cards flashback. The other two I see conflicting with each other, especially in Cube, because I think that the Mind Sculptor is probably the weakest of the four of the three, kind of, and I hate saying that.
Interesting.
But having played with them continually for the last couple months, because I've been in blue so much, the Mind Sculptor doesn't do what I want it to do almost ever. Bellerin is a 3-drop, I'm happy to play it. He always draws me cards. He's generally like resolving an Ancestral. It takes a couple turns, but it's very similar. I'm gonna draw 3 cards.
It's interesting because when I first added Bellerin, you didn't think it would be as good.
I know. And after playing with them and seeing and playing against them, this is like, I think my evaluation of them. The Mind Sculptor, because it does a brainstorm effect, is just worse. If the top of your library is bad, it's not getting better.
Well, you get to see 2 new cards each turn.
You get to see one. You draw one, so I see.
I see 2 each turn.
It just, man, it with that being a 0, it's not going up. It's not generating loyalty. You're not getting closer to winning. And the Fate Seal effect of the card is just not as good as Ashiok.
It's much easier to pressure Jace the Mind Sculptor than Jace Beleriand.
Right.
Because Jace Beleriand pluses to draw you cards.
Exactly, and the opponent doesn't want to target Jace Beleriand because they want to draw that extra card every 2 turns. Every 3 turns.
Right. Or it seems innocuous because it doesn't affect the board.
It's never going to bounce your spell, etc.
Yeah.
The Mind Sculptor always just gets killed, and then it just feels like a dead card in your deck. And this is kind of what we were talking about when we were talking about Jory. Is it Jorian?
Jorian.
Is that it's this innocuous type of card that I think that Beleriand fits into that category of it's great, it's innocuous, people aren't going to immediately remove it, versus the Mind Sculptor, which is something that demands an immediate removal, which means you're never going to resolve it and play it.
Well, I mean, the problem with that, though, is that as soon as people realize that Jace Beleriand is actually netting you a ton of fucking cards and you need to get rid of it, then that advantage sort of falls apart.
See, and I don't think Beleriand's ever going to fit into that category, though.
3-drop Planeswalkers in general are well-placed to be annoyingly hard to kill. They come down before you've established a board, before your opponent's established a board, really, except against the most aggressive decks.
I'm not saying Beleriand is ever going to win you a game, and that's why you don't remove Beleriand from the table when you're playing against it. It's just more likely for the blue deck who's playing other spells to give it an advantage than Jace the Mind Sculptor. Mind Sculptor will just win games sometimes. I'm not devaluing the card. I'm just saying, when I'm drafting, if both of those were in a pack together, I would probably take, and I'm not saying I would probably take Mind Sculptor still, but Beleriand is, I mean, I'm leaning more towards taking Beleriand now because I know it's going to give me something for my deck. I'll have utility from it.
Yeah, I don't know. I view them as just sort of different. Like,
that might be too
metagamey. I would always take Mind Sculptor over Beleriand.
Yeah.
I feel like they fit different roles, actually.
And my evaluation might be far too metagamey and bringing way too much opinion into it. Because it's just like, when I'm looking at the utility I get from resolving the card, I absolutely get more from resolving Beleriand.
I think I agree with you. I've had the best experience with Beleriand of all of my Jaces yesterday. He just felt like he fit into the right spot.
Right.
Well, I guess that's good news for me, getting my Mind Sculptor.
I'm not saying I'm passing a Mind Sculptor. Like I said, I'm not going to pass a Mind Sculptor. I'm just saying in the pack, if I open, if it's like pack one, pick one, and I have Belrune versus Mind Sculptor, I might pick Belrune because it's going to be a more useful card. Mm, all
right.
I have the potential of picking Mind Sculptor, though, and having extra fetch lands in my deck by just being like, fetch land, take it. So that's the idea of picking Mind Sculptor there. But okay, so a little bit more about your deck. You had three Jaces. You said that they were great.
Ooh, there's one good interaction I want to talk about. Liliana Heretical Healer with Jace Belrune. Well, Liliana Defiant Necromancer, really.
Okay.
My deck would eventually get my opponent empty-handed, either just by drawing more cards than my opponent, so I had more cards when they didn't, or by using Blightning some number of times.
Okay.
And I would be in a position where I didn't want to plus Jace to give them cards, but I wanted to draw more cards.
Okay.
And I eventually realized that if I plus Jace and then plus Liliana, my opponent still has no cards. Unless they have an instant they can cast.
That's true. No, that's true. Those are fun Planeswalker things. When I was talking, like, when I was playing with Jace and with Ashiok, and I was talking about whether or not I want to Fate Seal with Mind Sculptor or use Ashiok first.
Yeah.
Those are, like, the fun Planeswalker interactions you only get to check out every couple times, and you're like, oh my god, this is the best. So that's really cool to listen to.
Defiant Necromancer was so good for me this last time around.
Okay.
I had the right cards to trigger it. Snapcaster Mage is great for this.
Mm-hmm.
Shriek Maw is great for this. And just having the ability to recur creatures means that you don't mind your creatures dying. I did not have trouble flipping Liliana when I wanted to.
That's good. That's good for Liliana, because I kind of thought that she was a little bit lower on my list of cards to play, because she doesn't return any legendary creatures, which are a significant number of the cards in the cube.
She moved up my pick order after my experience yesterday.
That's pretty cool. Just one question before we leave, like, this Planeswalker area. You said to me last night, and I didn't want to contradict you in the game, because I like... Maybe it's shitty to say this, but you said that it was rough having three Jaces in your deck. You understand that playing Jace's Bringed Prodigy does not conflict with the Planeswalker rule, right?
The front side doesn't.
The front side doesn't. So you can play Vryn's Prodigy and play Belrune at the same time.
I found that anytime I used Vryn's Prodigy's ability, it would flip.
Okay. And to me, that just means that in deck building, you should have taken the Treasure Cruise a little bit higher.
I did take the Treasure Cruise, actually. But I was playing Dark Confidant, and I was pretty comfortable with my card draw.
Okay.
Dark Confidant was lucky for me last night, too.
Yeah, as you explained to us after we finished playing you and you won the whole thing, I think, if I remember correctly, you said, of the 9 draws I got off Dark Confidant, 7 of them were land, and the other 2 were less than 4 converted mana cost spells.
So, I flipped 10 cards over at least 3 different games, and I took a total of 5 damage.
Right.
I hit, I think, 8 lands, a 2-drop, and a 3-drop.
And that's an obscene ratio.
It's pretty good. This is the right deck for it, though. I have 5 1-drops, I have, like, 8 2-drops, and 6, 7 3-drops. Above that, I have Shriek Maw, Jace, and Dragonlord Solengar.
Your deck, the reason I liked playing against it last night, and the reason I was interested in playing against it...
I was counting Slaughter Pack as a 3-drop, it's actually a 0.
Well, the reason that I liked playing... It's a 3-drop, because you have to pay the 3 the next turn.
Not for Dark Confidant.
Not for Dark Confidant. The reason I liked playing against your deck, like I was trying to say last night, was that it seemed very similar to the blue-black deck I had played previously, about a month and a half ago. So it was really interesting to see kind of how you tooled it slightly differently in your draft compared to me. Because a number of the cards that were opened were similar, but you picked slightly different ones than I did. And I thought that it was interesting, because unlike the white-blue deck that we really disagreed last time on, and like which picks you were doing,
yep.
In this blue-black pack, you valued the cards that I valued really highly in your deck too. Like, you were playing Belrune and Dark Confidant and a Treasure Cruise, even though you had the Dark Confidant in, which I had done, and I lost life to the Treasure Cruise off of my Dark Confidant, but it was still fantastic, and I resolved it, and it was great. Because yeah. Drawing 5 cards in a turn is fantastic.
There was at least 2 games that would have killed me against Kaz.
But it was nice to see someone else play that deck, and I'm glad to see that deck was very good.
You want to talk about Yudin?
Sure. So I've been on this, like, weird drafting kick. So we came off the last time when I was drafting that horrible colorless can't-fit-in-anything deck. And in between these last 2 cubes, because we had this huge Christmas break, I ended up creating a modern deck, which is the Bringing Gifts deck. And it's got me kind of thinking in this toolbox mode, and this also different mode of playing the game, where before I was trying to constantly get value, and after playing with the Bringing Gifts deck, it's more of play heavily towards your late game, and be very aware of how many cards you can gain advantage off of by just doing Wraths. So when I opened in Pack 1, Pick 1 Narset, I knew that I just wanted to draft every Wrath I could find. Because Narset plus a rebounded Wrath gives me two turns of my opponent not doing anything and puts me so much closer to the late game. I also wanted to prove, because Narset's like a new addition to the cube, that Narset's fantastic. So I went into this draft thinking, I want to draft Wraths, and I want to draft a toolboxy deck.
Narset replaced Venser the Sojourner, because nobody wanted to play with Venser, and I would have put pretty much any blue-white card in that somebody wanted to see, and I'd wanted to see Narset.
And I think Narset performed really well. Reasons to like Narset. Rebounding Wraths, rebounding draw spells, rebounding burn spells, which puts her into like three completely different decks, and number four, she comes in at 6 loyalty, plusing to 7. She doesn't make a body like some of the other planeswalkers, but almost nothing on turn 4 passing over to the other player can kill her. Unless they are the mono-green ramp deck and they've gotten out their toughness and they're resolving that turn, they're hasting 5-4 that I can't... Serac. Unless you're facing down that, resolving Narset on turn 4 is not going to get it killed. Because her loyalty is so high, it's like resolving a planeswalker that has 3 loyalty and making a 3-3 body. Because she's not going to take more than 4 damage.
I thought that was the same argument for when she came out for Standard, too.
Right. And I like her in Standard, too. But that's my own bias for Standard. In Cube, she seemed to do really well for me last night. I ended up drafting this really weird deck. When we were in the draft, I was planning to play some sort of Esper deck. The blue wasn't panning out because I was sitting next to Paul and he was in blue. And I noticed that pack one because the only blue cards I was getting were blue-white cards. And I just knew that's what's happening. So I kind of thought, okay, I'm going to go black-white and see what kind of happens. So I was kind of really heavily in black-white in pack two, and I ended up grabbing some cards that I was evaluating differently from Vintage Cube and from watching. So I ended up grabbing Entomb, Reanimate, and Recurring Nightmare all in pack two, which did really well, and I was planning on being in black-white, so I was like, okay, I'm going to have tokens, I'm going to have Reanimate, I'm going to have some stuff to do. At the end of pack two, my last pick that I was passed was a Splinter Twin, and on reviewing packs between the two, between pack two and pack three, I realized that I'd also had Kiki-Jiki and Pestermite, which I didn't know I had. So going into pack three, my only goal was, let's make this deck toolboxy. I want to be in Mardu, because I just wanted to cut off blue entirely from my deck. I just wanted to be in red, white, black. Wanted to be in some kind of Mardu Reanimator deck, okay? In that pack, in the first couple of picks, I think it was pack, it was like picks 2, 3, and 1, 2, and 3, I had gotten a Taiga, a Plateau, and a Scalding Tarn, which locked in my red, which I wasn't planning on playing. And then I ended up realizing that I had a Coalition Relic, and I was just like, you know what, I'm gonna go super deep this draft, I'm gonna play Wooburg, and I'm gonna play all of these Wraths that I've gotten, which were like Tragic Arrogance, Parallax Wave, Fire Spout. I was gonna rebound them, I was gonna play my Brimaz, play my Monastery Mentor, and just gain value, and then if I needed to, Entomb a Kiki-Jiki, and then reanimate it. To give me my Pestermite combo, or just play Splinter Twin on something to get value, like on my Baneslayer Angel. And that's exactly what my deck did, and it went fantastic.
It was one of the most competent 5-color decks I've seen.
It was weird. The reason that it worked as a 5-color deck was that it was actually a Mardu deck. The blue splash in it was literally Pestermite and Narset, and I had a Coalition Relic, a Signet, and I had 7 sources of mana without adding basics to hit them, just off of my fetches and my dual lands. And then after that, like, the reason green was playable was because, again, the Simic Signet, and then the Coalition Relic, and again, I had 6 sources of green without adding basics. So my splashes were simple, and I added Primeval Titan for the Reanimator portion. I never got to play it, I never drew it, so it really, I feel like when I'm looking at my deck for review, I was just playing a 4-color deck, because I never played anything green. I didn't even resolve the Fire Spout for green. I only ever resolved it for red, because I wanted to destroy things on the ground.
Yeah, red is typically the more important half.
Right, and you can cast it for both, and I did cast it for both at once, because I was just like, whatever, I'm tapping something for green, and I'm tapping something red to cast it, so it was hitting both abilities, but that was kind of how the deck went. Really, really weird. I wasn't sure it was going to work out because of the triple red on Kiki-Jiki and like the double white on things like Baneslayer Angel, but I was in one game against Kaz able to go Baneslayer Angel turn 5, Kiki-Jiki turn 6, attack Gideon for 10. I think I still lost that game because we ended up going to a game 3, but it was a really fun game.
The end of your game 3 was a pretty nice
place. The end of the game 3 was the most... No. That was the most synergistic thing I could possibly have done in this deck. Game 3, Kaz had been destroying all of my lands. I was down to two lands and a Coalition Relic, and I had a Pestermite on the field.
Kaz had played Braids.
Oh, no, I didn't have the Pestermite on the field yet. Pestermite in my hand and the Splinter Twin in my hand. And an Entomb.
And Kaz's deck, as we mentioned before, makes a lot of permanents, so he wasn't sacrificing lands. He had both creatures and lands in play to spare, I think.
Yeah. I had a Monastery Mentor on the field, and I was going to make a Monk token when I cast Entomb. I knew that I had Recurring Nightmare in my hand, and I had Splinter Twin, and I had Pestermite in my hand. So when Kaz went to destroy my lands, he was destroying one of my lands, and I had my Coalition Relic tapped, which meant that I couldn't actually play Splinter Twin the next turn, but I had already preemptively put in a Kiki Jiki like a turn before into my graveyard with Entomb, and I had a Recurring Nightmare in my hand, so I knew I was going to be fine, but then I realized I could just cast Pestermite in response to him destroying my land with the three lands I had untapped.
Tapping the Coalition Relic.
Untap the Coalition Relic, then tap the Coalition Relic and put a storage counter on it to be able to untap and play Splinter Twin without having to do the Kiki Jiki.
Thus making it to the fourth...
Thus making it to the fourth mana, regardless of whether or not I drew a red land, which was the constrainment, because he was taking me off of red on purpose.
So he had to use the Coalition Relic to cast Pestermite and untap it, put a counter on it, so you could use Coalition Relic twice to cast Splinter Twin.
I didn't actually use it to cast Pestermite. I used the land that he was blowing up to cast the Pestermite.
You sacrificed a Monk token, actually, that turn.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
to the Braids.
Not a land, but...
I had to sacrifice the land to Kaz blowing it up.
Oh, okay. Much more direct.
It was much more direct. So it was just a... It was a really cool way to end the game, because I had not actually Splinter Twinned... I had not Pestermite comboed out the entire day.
And you did it off two lands.
And I did it off two lands, and I had been very aware of the combo in multiple games. There were multiple games where I was one turn off doing it, and I just didn't, because I either won or I lost horribly on those turns from having a Kiki Jiki and a Baneslayer Angel, or from being overrun by the fantastic red deck that Goodspeed was playing by damage. But it just, like...
Against you, I cast Blightning twice, and you ended up discarding the
combo.
And
you forced me to discard the combo. The first time you cast it, it wasn't an issue. The second time you cast it, I discarded the combo. Otherwise, I was going to win when you did, if you had passed it back to me.
Yeah.
And you weren't going to be able to counter it, because I knew your hand at that point. So it was just like...
Yeah, but...
But you did. So, I mean, and that's what happens. But that was the fun part of this. This deck was so much fun to play, because it was toolboxy. And that's what I was trying to build when I made it, and it did exactly what I wanted to do. And I really liked it. The Super Friends combo in it, like when I was playing against Paul, because I knew he had removal, I just put in three more Planeswalkers for my sideboard, because I could play all five colors.
I did the work to kill those Planeswalkers.
I forced him to work. I knew I was going to lose. I lost him game one, and I knew it. Like, I knew I was going to lose to him as soon as he played correctly and used Slaughter Pact to kill my creature very early in the game, which I thought was really surprising, because it was really... It wasn't, like, an incredible creature. I think I had just played, a Pestermite early.
It was a Monastery Mentor.
Was it a Monastery Mentor? I didn't think that was a very threatening play when I played it. I didn't really have anything to pump it when I played it, and you killed it early, and then I drew into something that would have made it horrifying. So I was just like, oh...
I had a Yawgmoth's Fill in my hand.
I know. And in hindsight, you have that's the vision that you have when you're playing blue-black. But I think the hard thing about playing a blue-black deck is being able to evaluate what are the threats. What do I need to get rid of now? What can I save until later so that I can get value off of something... get a two-for-one, essentially. And I think you correctly evaluated that game, which is why... I mean, I was really impressed when you played that game, because I haven't seen you play blue-black for a very long time. So it was really impressive that you evaluated everything correctly that first game. And then knowing that, going into the second game, I knew after seeing you do that the first game, I was never winning games two or three based off of how good your deck was compared to mine, because my deck is so weird. If I faltered at all, you were going to beat me. So I was just like, I'm going to go all in on the fact that he probably only has one Planeswalker removal spell, because he's got all of this creature removal and recursion, and I'm just going to go full hand and put in three more Planeswalkers. So I put in the Garruk, I put in a Johnny, and I put in the Planeswalker Nissa, the one that I hate the most.
Right.
And they did well in game two. I delayed longer than game one.
Game two, I was under a lot of pressure.
But it was not a good time.
I had to sequence my plays very carefully in game two. I had the advantage of Una's Prowler, being able to attack in the air against your Planeswalkers.
You did.
And I had the advantage of Blightning with Snapcaster Mage twice. And that is actually, I think, what ended up killing both Sorin and Nissa.
Yeah, the fact that I had to discard...
Then you played Narset.
You didn't get a full eight cards off of doing that to me, but you got... I think you got six by doing that.
It was...
It was an obscene amount of cards that I got, like, mind-twisted so much that game. It was, like, every time I felt like I was getting advantage off of drawing cards, even if it was off of, like, if it was off of my Gnar set, if it was off of just taking a couple turns where you were doing nothing after I'd Wrathed, it was, like, ugh.
I wasn't even super far ahead after killing Soren and Nissa, because you still had both 4/4s.
Yeah.
I ended up trading Snapcaster plus Una's Prowler for one land. And you had a second one, which I think I Shriek Mawed.
There was a point in that game where I had multiple lands animated, and I think I had three animated. Well, I had two, you killed one, and then I was animating the next one, and then those two stuck around. At that point in the game, I could see you faltering, so I knew I had to go full in, and you top decked well. And yes, the top deck that you got was a Recursion, and it was a Snapcaster Mage, and I was just screwed as soon as you did that.
Even after this whole sequence, I ended up with, like, a Shriek Maw and an empty board. We just had lands.
Right.
You play a Gnar set. Shriek Maw doesn't pressure Gnar set a whole lot, and you might have gotten rid of it somehow, but I top decked Dragonlord Silumgar.
I will point out at that time, too, when you top deck Dragonlord Silumgar, I was down to a Tundra, a Forest, and a Gnar set.
You had a mana Orok, too. You had Simic Signet,
I had a Simic Signet. I had three mana, though, combating, like, nine.
No, I played my sixth land to play Silumgar, I thought. My sequencing was really, really tight that game.
It was rough, though. I was like, I'm losing in mana. I mean, I knew I was in a bad spot. This is why I hate Nissa. When Nissa is doing well, she's great. As soon as your opponent starts to deal with her, not only does she deal with her, but she screws you so hard.
Yeah.
Like, you can win with her, and you can win really well, or you can lose horribly.
You could end up with nothing in play and also not enough lands.
Right. So, yeah, that was my deck. Long-winded, lots of dual lands, lots of fetch lands, Coalition Relic is the best, and some toolboxing. Don't underestimate Magister of Worth. That was a card that I used to like playing about a year ago, a lot, when I was playing Reanimator more.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with that card again last night when I cast it and Wrathed, and then reanimated it and Wrathed, and then when I Kiki'd it and Wrathed. It was just everything I wanted.
All right. Good speed. Do you want to say anything at all, or do you just want to...
No, my deck sucked.
So that brings us to the thing that we talked about over break. I'm going to quote you.
No, hold on. I'll put it this way.
We had a chat on Facebook. I actually liked the way you put some of these things.
Before we get to this, when I first started playing Cube, Mono White was, like, the best thing ever. that's also when a bunch of conspiracies were in, but that's probably not relevant to the point. Basically, the way I felt last night was there were a ton of red and green aggro, and just green in general cards going around that nobody wanted. Despite having a really good pack one, where I was in an artifact-based deck, that seemed pretty good.
Tell me your first however many picks.
My first pick was Sheldrak Isle. My second pick was Spellskite, which was probably wrong, but whatever. I think that was the pack where there were six really good red cards, and I was like, I'm not taking any of these, because everyone that I'm passing to is going to go into red. Turns out no one did, but we'll get to that later. And then my third pick was Grim Monolith. So I was like, alright, worst case scenario, I have three playable cards. And then no one was in red-green, and I was completely forced in, because everyone took all the other cards I would have wanted, and my deck sucked.
So you were playing, I would call it red-green mid-range?
Sure.
It didn't lean too far to the aggro side. You went 1-2.
Yep.
I played blue-black with some red,
mm-hmm.
And I went 3-0.
Right.
Over break, we had a fairly lengthy discussion about aggro and cube, and how it's changed, and the current state of it.
Sure.
You asked me initially, did you intentionally kill mono white aggro in cube?
Yes.
And I was like, I don't know if that's really true. But we kept talking, and we got to the heart of the issue wasn't just mono white aggro, it was aggro.
No, the heart of the issue is mono white. I think there is an aggro problem in general, but it applies a lot more to white than it does to red.
Red and white don't have any broken cards on the level of blue, black, and green. The last good aggro card you added was Parallax Wave. You downgraded Consul's Lieutenant and cut Isamaru. It was kind of the starting point of our conversation.
Yep.
So I'm going to take a look at one of the claims that I haven't done anything to support aggro.
And I'll preface this. I did research all of these things before I said any of this to Paul. I went and looked at all the changes that had been made to red and white cards since about May of last year, and I stand by my statements that these cards are all downgrades.
I didn't go quite as far as you. I only went back to July.
Sure.
Isamaru became Kithion.
Which is a downgrade.
Maybe.
In my opinion.
Isn't it a 2-1 for a 2-1?
No, it's a 2-2 for a 2-1.
Isamaru is a 2-2.
Okay.
Kithion is a human, which matters slightly.
For one card.
It matters for Champion of the Parish.
Right.
It's not the worst. Kithion also has other upsides that have never come up.
You're right, exactly. I think they're completely irrelevant.
So
not completely. But
that may be the case with Kithion. I cut Thunderbreak region for Avalanche Riders.
Sure, I'm okay with that, but again, I didn't start talking about red.
I cut Torch Fiend for Keldon Marauders.
It's also fine.
I cut Dragon Hunter for Vryn Wingmare.
A abject downgrade.
That was on purpose.
Okay, as I said.
But I then cut Vryn Wingmare.
Sure, for a non-aggro card.
For Monastery Mentor.
Which is not an aggro card.
Right, right. So overall, we lost Dragon Hunter and gained Monastery Mentor.
Right.
I also cut a quarter paladin for Consul's Lieutenant, which
also an abject downgrade.
You said was a downgrade. I've had a good experience with Consul's Lieutenant, but I only played with it one time.
Sure.
I never really liked a quarter paladin that much.
I love it.
I think it's always one of the... felt whenever I had it in play, it would trade.
A quarter paladin is one of the strongest signals that white aggro is open. Consul's Lieutenant is not, because no one takes it ever.
Beyond that, Chandra Pyromaster became Kargan Dragonlord, and Kargan Dragonlord became Skirk Trailblazer.
I have never seen Kargan Dragonlord.
Because it's not anymore.
It was in for all of a month.
In which we barely played.
Nobody wants to pay red for a card that costs, like, four more red mana.
Well, it had the same issue as the Merfolk that was in for a little while.
Yeah, it's worse, though, because that required colorless to level up.
Right, and that one wasn't good enough, so it makes sense that this one was out.
The Merfolk is Coral Helm Commander.
Yeah, there we go.
I figured that pretty quickly, so we moved on. I think maybe the most controversial thing on this list is Monastery Swift Spear was cut for Zergal Bellstriker.
Which I like.
I wanted to cut Legion Loyalist.
No.
Which you like.
Legion Loyalist is one of the best red aggro cards in the cube.
So, just to sum things up, it kind of seems like there's two cuts from the cube that you think are the reasons that white is downhill.
Yeah.
Isamaru for Kithion.
Yes.
Which we were testing because Flipwalkers came out.
Sure.
And we didn't know if the Indestructible Clause would be super... We thought that the Indestructible Clause, when Paul initially added it, was going to be absurd. Which is why we thought it was an upgrade.
Sure.
It's proven to not be.
Right.
So it sounds like you're kind of moving forward to say, let's put Isamaru back in.
So
and
I don't think Isamaru should have been cut at all. I think Kithion should have replaced another card, maybe a non-aggro card. I don't think aggro was too good at that point. But for some reason, we see a trend towards cutting down on aggro significance.
So I
don't think it's a steep trend. And in red, it's not true. But in white, you have a point. But I think it might be exaggerated.
Maybe.
I think the main reason you're feeling what you're feeling is that the cube has grown since white was strong. White has largely lost overall. Overall, looking at these, white aggro lost one card total, which was the change of Dragon Hunter to a Monastery Mentor in general. That's one card. At the same time, the cube has grown by 50 cards to 100, which makes aggro harder to play.
Right, this is my point, is these colors have nothing broken, which is why I insisted that Winter Orb got added, which it has been now. But, I'll bring this up now, in the cube draft we had yesterday, how many aggressive one-drops got opened? I counted four, and they were in three different colors.
I think, I understand where you're coming from, but at the same time, when I look at this, it seems slightly misplaced for the reasoning that you're advocating putting in non-unique creatures. Any one drop that you put in is going to be a one drop, and if it's good, it's going to have two power and one toughness. They're all replaceable, none of them are unique.
Okay, but
like adding more mana creatures to green.
Which has been done since this started. This is my point. I don't think it's a downside to have three or four 1-mana 2/1s for white get opened. Because a deck will want them, and a deck will play all of them. And someone will be in that deck, if they're available. And right now they just aren't, so no one can play the deck. This is why I started this by asking, did you intentionally kill it? Because I think it's dead. I don't think you can draft a white aggro deck and win.
I don't think that's true. I think it's just more like Storm is in Vintage Cube.
Okay, we have never drafted with 8 people. Storm is unplayable in that cube with less than 8 people.
I want to get to that point.
White aggro never was with 4 or 5.
I want to get to that point.
Sure.
But there's a lot of facets to this discussion. You went on to say that every deck in the last 4 months has been blue or black or both.
Sure.
And this most recent cube is like the perfect example of the blue-black devil, because that's the deck I was playing, and how...
What were the winners of the last 4 drafts?
I went back and looked before I said that.
This was blue-black. The one before this was me with blue-black.
Okay.
I don't know the other two.
I think I had
Before that, it was you.
And I think I was playing blue-black.
And then it was me with Grixis Artifact Walkers.
So there is almost definitely validity to that statement.
I mean, blue and black are pretty overpowered, I'm going to be honest, compared to other colors.
It does feel, and I did notice this in the draft last night, that the prime picks in blue are at the level, and this is why I mean, and this is an evaluation that I kind of brought up when I was talking about my deck. When I was looking at blue and black, I said that Entomb looked like an Imperial Seal to me. When I was playing last night, I was looking at the draft like it was a Vintage Cube, and I was just not getting the Moxen, and that's why I was drafting the way I did, which was absurd. And I did fine. I went 2-2. In that type of looking at the cube, since that was the way I evaluated it, I would never have considered playing an aggro deck.
I don't think you would normally consider playing an aggro deck.
I did play green recently.
Well, but Ed has also won with white aggro.
And I have also won with white aggro, and I did consistently for 3 drafts in a row when we started playing. So I'm not saying, and I used to evaluate white as the strongest color in the cube. So I'm not saying that there's any negative credibility towards what's going on. I really like where the cube is right now, but I think that it's very, very positive for Goodspeed to have an objection to the fact that an area that he likes playing and an area that should maybe be in the cube seems like it's downgraded, and maybe it's because we didn't take into account, or you didn't take into account when we were developing it, that we weren't playing with 8 people.
So, I want to make changes to the cube. In fact, I have been and plan to do that.
No, you always do. And we're not being, like, critical at all. This is just a constructive, this is what's going on with the cube right now.
Alright, and I'm the one who put this on the docket. I want to talk about it. To the claim, well, before last night's cube, I think it was more ambiguous about the blue-black claim. I'm more on board with it now, having just played blue-black, and felt intuitively that it was very powerful.
Did you ever feel like things were out of your control, even in the most competitive game?
Yeah, I could very easily have lost against Kaz both games. I required some incredible lines to stay in the middle of those games.
Okay. When I won, I never felt like I was out of control. I never felt like I needed a top deck. I felt like my deck was doing exactly what it needed to do.
Maybe I'm overestimating the incredibility of my plays or my draws or whatever. I was lucky and my deck was good.
When I played against you, and this was just me playing against you, it felt like there was nothing I could do that would beat you at all. And that is the blue-black wall, and that's why I was so heavily into it and why I so heavily advocated people take more cards from it, because it felt like when I played it and won, and I played with Ashiok and did so well, that I should tell people that these cards need to be highly picked, more highly picked. Because when one player ends up in them, it becomes absurd if they get all of the picks.
It also makes me wonder if the evaluation of Ashiok, like how being in blue and black influences how people perceive it now. Like if we accept the claim that blue-black are just better colors, they're more likely to win, their cards are more powerful, then Ashiok is in the perfect place to look really good, even if...
I don't agree with... So what you're saying is that that Ashiok is being over-evaluated because of the colors?
Ashiok looks really good right now because the cube is slanted in its favor.
I don't think that's the reason Ashiok is so good. Ashiok, I just recently witnessed during a 24-hour stream that Humph did, was played in Vintage Cube. It was heavily under-evaluated, and he lost to it.
I believe it.
And I watched him in the draft not discuss Ashiok when it came around. He was in blue-black. He took a draw spell, didn't even reference the fact that Ashiok was in the pack, and just sent it around. And he lost to the card, and I went, you are being silly. That Planeswalker is absurd, especially in decks where decks are 40 cards, and it exiles them.
Okay. I don't want to go too far on this tangent.
That's a tangent.
My two biggest responses to the claim that blue and black always win are that a deck that is blue or black or both is 7 of 10 two-color decks.
Yeah, that's a bullshit response, and you know it.
And
when I said that, I didn't mean blue or black as a splash. They're main blue or main black or both. That's much more significant than saying it's 7 out of 10 colors you can have. This is nowhere near what I was implying.
If we ignore three-color decks,
sure,
just talk about two-color decks, still 70% of decks are going to be playing a significant amount of blue.
If you go and look, it's not 70% of the combinations you can have.
The other thing I had to say about this is that we actually haven't had a heck of a lot of XO decks. We have a lot of X1s. We have more X1s than XOs in round robins, at the very least. It doesn't mean that blue and black isn't still the best performing. I just wanted to temper that claim and bring it up that way.
Sure.
I think that the way that you bring that up without it being so inflammatory is to say that any two-color pair has a 70% play rate, with the color exception, I think, being probably green.
Okay.
Being, like, a green pairing probably being a little bit lower, because green is probably going to be more mono-green than another pair. I don't think you can say that, because looking at the color wheel and saying that color... There are just certain colors and certain cards in the cube that go better together, so it can't just be evaluated as... 70% of the cube will be playing this. I don't know if that comes across well, or you get what I'm saying.
So 70% of decks at face value on the color wheel isn't the same as 70% of actual decks that get played.
Right.
You think that blue and black cards tend to synergize and pull towards each other?
I think that they do. Well, I think they do. Look at the decks that were played last night. What were the five decks played last night?
I played blue, black, and about half as much red as the other two colors.
Okay.
Kaz played Abzan. How do you think your colors were distributed?
Mostly green.
So Abzan waved towards green.
Okay.
You had...
He was still playing black.
Yeah.
I had Mardu with blue and also red. Well, Mardu with blue and then Primeval Titan, but let's exclude the Primeval Titan because I never cast it. So I had Mardu with blue, which meant that I was playing black and blue.
And I had red, green, and Matt had blue, black. And who did the worst? The only deck not playing blue or black.
That's not true. You didn't play Matt.
Okay.
No one else played Matt, so you can't devaluate it that way.
My deck did the worst, though.
I technically did as bad as you.
You Matt, went 1-2?
Yes. Although my games were far closer.
Right.
Matt went 0-1.
That's my point, I didn't deserve to beat Ed.
Matt went 0-1.
Sure, but you're the one who said he had a good deck.
Matt did have a very good deck.
I think the claim I remember from Matt is that Matt's deck may have had the best chance of beating my deck, because I didn't have answers to...
Big mana early.
Big mana threats. I had answers to early game and mid-range threats, primarily.
The reason I thought that Matt could beat the mid-range deck that Goodspeed was playing was that Goodspeed's deck seemed solidly fair. Matt's was broken. When Goodspeed plays... 3 2/2s or 3 4/4s and destroys a land, Matt's going to look at that. Matt was essentially playing a deck that felt like Tron. He's just going to resolve a mere battle sphere and have infinite blockers and just deal you damage.
He had a lot of mana artifacts. A lot of artifacts in general.
He's just going to play a Kozilek and annihilate everything he put on the field. His deck was very impressive in the two games I played against it. I don't think you would have gone 3-0 if you had played against him, because I think it would have beaten you. However... That deck got kind of pulled and excluded. It was playing blue. I don't know. Did you look through the deck list? Was it playing any blacks?
It's right there. Pretty sure. Yeah, he was playing Fleshbag Marauder and Read the Bones. Top of my head.
So
he has Night's Whisper as well.
So what I would posit is that black is the more broken color. And I'm going to posit that, pointing out that black has all of the removal, and it has all of the broken enablers that are from Vintage, and blue isn't playing those. And it would be interesting, I think that blue is abusing the black portion because blue is drawing you to the broken black cards. I don't think that blue is actually broken.
Been saying black has been OP for a while.
I know. And I know Kaz has been saying that, but I honestly think that the broken card is black.
All right. One of the decks that won in the time period I'm talking about was blue-green.
Which deck?
Which was absurd because of the blue spells that Paul played it.
It was going back a couple months. I was playing blue-green. It was like a... More green than blue, but it was like a toolboxy deck where I...
Was it Upheaval?
Simic, Sky
no.
Swallower, people plot.
There's a variation that happens, and if you, and I've said this again about Simic Sky Swallower and Shrouded or protection creatures, anytime a protection creature comes down, it's going to win. And I think that you specifically, Goodspeed, since you go so heavily aggro and have lost to that absurdity so many times,
right,
have the right to be angry at this. No, because I know that I played a Sphinx of the Steel Wind against you and won 2 weeks ago, which is blue, black, white. Like, that is blue and black. It is protection. It is bullshit. And I said from the beginning of the cube, when we used to have swords, when we used to have Pristine Angel, etc., that the issue and the reason people get really angry is when they lose to something out of nowhere, and those come from those cards that have you lose on them. They don't say you win the game, but you do. And those cards are only present in blue and black right now.
They're in green, too. Natural Order can just win you the game, and so can Rathalos, but...
That's fine.
That's why I felt like including it, what I said. Red and white have no broken cards.
I think
green absolutely does.
Green is far more tempered, though.
Sure.
You need a lot more synergy going on.
Can you think of...
Had I been in mono green last night, I would have done a lot better than I did.
Okay.
Sure.
So this is just me coming from a jaded perspective. In Vintage and in Legacy, everyone refers to white as colorless.
Sure.
Can you think of a white card that is as broken as anything any of the other colors can do that could fix this issue?
Okay, Paul brought this up to me. He said, make suggestions. Changes. I wanted Winter Orbin, I want Hero of Blade Holden, I want Isamaru and a Colder Paladin back in.
I did want to say that, like, I find it weird that, like, Hero of Blade Holden is considered so strong, is too strong, when we have ridiculous blue cards like Treachery or ridiculous black cards. It's just like, why is Hero of Blade Holden too strong? Like, why are we limiting White's strongest cards?
All right, before we go any further, I want to address that claim. I will talk about the cards that are going to change in the next period of time. I want to talk about my ideology when making changes to the cube in the last year.
I just want to preface kind of what we've been talking about just for Paul's sake. When I talk about these kind of things, I'm just trying to make general observations. I'm not criticizing. I've had a fantastic time playing over the last year, and I think you've done a really good job at making small changes every single time. It's just the conversations that we're doing is trying to promote the continued play that we've been having, because we've done really well at playing almost every other week or every week, because we all like doing it so much.
Yep.
Counterpoint, I hate playing cube now because I can never win.
That's what we're talking about.
Right.
It's just, it's a really interesting statement that you made that today, because 2 days ago I heard you say, I want to play cube every single day.
I would absolutely do this. I think if I did this more often, I'd have more data and would understand the problems better. But we don't play very often. I'm not saying I want to stop playing. I just, it's not fun because I'm forced into a deck every single draft that isn't open or playable. It's open, but it's not, it's never going to win.
We've identified that aggro and especially white doesn't look good right now.
Right.
Historically, White is the best color, right? We've all had that idea.
White was about a year ago. White was a year ago, and then I left for about 4 months, so I have no idea what happened during that
time. I'll say white was visibly the most successful color.
Mm-hmm. That was when conspiracies could reduce deck size and made aggro better.
It continued after we cut the conspiracies. I will say that the density of aggro cards in the cube is a concern, but I haven't been focusing on white because I wasn't worried about white for a long time. For a while, green was probably the weakest color. That's not true anymore.
And that was from the reaction from the beginning when we started playing and white-green was broken.
And then red was the weakest color, and that started out as by design. It's really hard to get a significant amount of data. I mean, like, statistically significant amount of data.
We don't play as much as Moto does.
So I take a lot of advice from the Moto articles about cube that have access to the data from the Magic Online cube.
Right.
They make decisions based on it, and they talk about it in the article. So, Randy Bueller made this observation I remember thinking about when putting together the red section originally, and making changes to it for a long time. Quote, "The really interesting data comes when you compare the average draft pick of cards among people who won their draft to the average position among other drafters. Of the top 30 cards on that list, 29 are mono-red aggro cards, with Sulfuric Vortex having the biggest difference. Clearly, mono-red decks are too efficient, and while I'm happy to have mono-red be around as an option, it shouldn't just be easier to win with than the other archetypes." So when I put the cube together initially, I kind of skirted around some of the best mono-red cards. Sulfuric Vortex wasn't one that's been in the entire time, because I wanted there to still be exciting cards in red, and red was doing fine. We reached a point where I thought red was probably the weakest color, and I made a bunch of changes to red. We look back at the history of the last, like, 6 months. Red has more changes than white, and much more aggressive changes than white. Like, much bigger positive improvements.
And I think that, I mean, as the person that I said before that I hate red, I don't think I've ever touched red, really. I've started playing with it recently, and I think that I've kind of felt that it has increased in value. I think that's probably fair to say.
If we're looking at why aggro colors have become weak, it's because I wasn't too worried about them. If we're just talking about red and white, with the rationale that white was fine before.
Right.
And red didn't need to be as good as it could be to be good enough.
And you've been working a lot on the multicolors things, which makes sense. We've been trying to fix lands, we've been trying to fix signets, there's a lot that you've been working on.
So let's talk about specific changes. And changes with an eye to increasing the density and power of aggro cards, especially in white. I asked Goodspeed to make a bunch of suggestions that he thought would definitely fix the problem. I think those are my exact words. The problem as he saw it. So he told me to cut a cycle of lands, and he suggested I cut the shock lands.
Okay.
I'm okay with that. We had just added a fourth cycle of dual lands, and we were up to 56 of the cards in the cube being land cards. And that means that there's a lot of lands. Each player, there's 420 cards, and every player adds 42 cards to the draft because they add 3 packs of 14. That means that every player is adding 5.6 lands to a draft.
Did you say they add 42?
Yeah, 14
times
3.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. Okay, sorry.
So So they all add 5.6 lands to the draft. Cutting the cycle of lands means that the number of lands is going to go down to like 4.6-ish. That should make decks a little clumsier in general if they're trying to play a lot of colors. It also means that there will be less lands watering down packs instead of like other cards.
I think that's a good idea.
So I'm going to cut the shock lands.
I don't know if I agree with that. And I'm going to cite two reasons for saying that. One, the aggro deck wants shock lands in the opponent's decks, and the higher Wooburg someone goes with shock lands, the more likely they are to take damage. I think it would be safer to cut the dual lands straight up if you're trying to improve aggro.
I made the same argument, actually, but Goodspeed still stuck with the Shocklands as his choice. So I'm going to run with it. We'll see how it goes. Ranger of Eos is going to be cut for Hero of Bladehold. I was hoping to have it for Cube yesterday, actually, but...
I have a promo.
Yeah, but it's ugly.
That's understandable. It's really fugly.
Winter Orb is already in.
Mm-hmm.
Just added. Ankh of Misha, also just added.
Which was annoying to play against with Matt, but he was playing the big mana deck, and it worked very well for him.
I also got the suggestion to add Zealous Conscripts.
No.
I don't understand how that helps aggro, but that's
not quite what I said.
Well, tell me what you said.
I said add a good red card, add a broken red card, and I don't know what they are. Fire Blast is a much better option than Zealous Conscripts, in my opinion.
So you asked me what are red cards that are broken on their own.
Right.
I suggested three things. Two of them, seriously. Imperial Recruiter, I suggested, is a broken red card.
What does that card do?
It is 3-mana 1/1.
What does it say?
When it enters the battlefield, search your library for a creature card with power 2 or less, reveal it, put it into your hand, then shuffle.
You kind of liked it.
Oh yeah, I like Fire Blast and Zealous Conscripts more. Again, I don't think red has an aggro problem, I think red just has a power problem.
I don't think red has a power problem.
But
I end up playing red every week.
It's because no one else will draft it.
Well, I don't think Imperial Recruiter seems that good to me, but whatever, I don't play aggro that much, so I guess I can't really say. I don't want Zealous Conscripts in. I very much agreed with your idea that I don't want Zealous Conscripts to be a stupid combo with Kiki Jiki and just have it be in one color. I think that's dumb. I just know I'm going to hate dying to a Splinter Twin.
Can I? This is going to be a really inflammatory question, but I need to ask this before we talk about doing more big changes to the cube, because it sounds like we're cutting dual lands and we're adding things.
Sure.
When have you seriously drafted something that's not a single color?
I have only drafted a single color once, and it was on the no gold cards day. I always draft at least two colors.
Okay, and what are your two colors that you always draft?
We have the records of every deck I've drafted.
It's red, green,
every
or
color.
Red, white.
Right.
Okay, that's what I want to draft because no one else is ever in it. But that can't happen anymore because there just aren't enough cards.
So it sounds like you had a success rate with a specific deck for a very long time that worked well for you, and you're hesitant to try and learn new strategies.
No, I have been trying to learn new strategies for the last 4 months, and it fails miserably because either I'm getting horrible signals sent to me, or I'm trying to draft blue, and it's just never open. And there's no way for me to manipulate that. This is my problem. Last night I wanted to draft an artifact opposition deck. The guy I was passing to ended up with the artifact deck. It wasn't my fault. I didn't draft wrong. He just got lucky in what he opened passing right. Did I say opposition?
Yes.
I meant upheaval. Sorry.
I mean, that happens.
This is the problem.
That's not a problem.
It's a problem when I feel like I'm being forced into a strategy, because it's the only thing open. So, and it's just not good enough to ever win.
I don't want to confuse Goodspeed's choice of a narrow band of strategies with whether or not those strategies are viable. So I think we've done enough to at least establish they are weaker than other strategies in the cube, when they don't need to be.
I agree with that. At the same time, I don't think butchering what's existing in the cube, which is a healthy multicolor set...
Nothing is getting butchered. This is my whole point. I have no problem with other colors being strong. I want red and white to be competitive, because I don't think they are right
Removing five dual lands is significant.
Ten dual lands? I think forcing people to play two colors is fair. I don't see a problem with that. I think the fixing is so good, people will take the nut white cards, and then aggro just has nothing left. Because Elspeth Terrell is getting splashed in a blue-black deck.
We played with 32 colored lands last night. How did you feel the fixing was last night?
It was fantastic for me. I drafted them specifically.
So it sounds like it still works for all the strategies we want to play. Like, we all played three or more colored decks.
Was this change in effect yesterday?
Yeah. There were no shock lands in the cube yesterday.
If that's the case, then I'm fine playing it like that. I just see that as a very aggressive move and a very large portion of something that I think is healthy right now.
After we cut the cycle of lands, we're still adding 4.6 lands to the cube per person. I have two other ideas that might help aggro.
The more I think about it, the more I just love Zealous Conscript.
I'm in for Zealous Conscript. It makes Kiki Jiki better, and it makes Splinter Fang better.
That's why I don't like it. It's four cards. It's something that someone can have in their deck, and it's just stupid. I hated losing yesterday to you with that stupid Splinter Twin. And, like, keeping it red already, that's like three of the cards in red. It's frustrating. I think Zell's Conscripts is an amazing aggro card, so...
What if I cut Splinter Twin to put Conscripts in?
I don't like that.
I mean, I like it, but I know that other people have resistance to that.
I like playing busted combos in the cube, and that's fine. You can take out a busted combo if you're going to try and improve aggro. But that's my hesitance with you taking out all of the shock lands and then also taking out busted combos. It's the healthiness that I feel like is in the cube right now, which is giving red an ability to win by having the busted combo.
I'm sorry, I have no problem with where red's at.
You have no problem with where it is right now because it has Splinter Twin and Kiki Jiki, and it also has a whole bunch of burn. But as soon as you take out one of those balances, it's going to change. There's a difference between adding cards and cutting cards. I have no issue with you adding 14 one mana 2/1s to white. I have an issue when you say you're going to cut good cards that I evaluate well, that I think fit well with the rest of the cards in cube.
Splinter Twin only fits with one card in the cube.
That's not true. Splinter Twin attaches to any creature to save it from dying when someone clones it, which I did 4 times last night. You tap the creature on the Splinter Twin, and you attack with the token.
Historically, that's a very narrow use of it. It pretty much only plays with Pestermite.
I mean, I think Kiki Jiki is just a broader version of that effect that can you can have lots of fun with in other decks.
You cannot have fun with Kiki in other decks unless you are reanimating it because of its triple red cost. What other card has triple red and it's literally Massacre Worm? Or a triple color and it's Massacre Worm?
And Cryptic Command.
And Cryptic Command. You cannot just splash Cryptic Command.
Grizzlebrand has 4 black. I cast that in a 3-color deck. I honestly, last time I played Kiki Jiki in a 3-color deck, it was fine.
Okay.
Straight adding Zealous Conscripts pushes the power of the Twin Kiki combos a lot. I don't think that's the area of red that I'm interested in pushing.
I would also like to say, I think Hellrider's fantastic.
Well, that is the last thing on my list, is Hellrider. So I pushed you a little bit to make you say this, but you said that if you were going to cut something, you would cut Avalanche Riders for it?
Yeah.
I know you said you had more respect for Avalanche Riders last night after seeing Goodspeed play it.
Goodspeed did do work. It did, from Goodspeed, though, it sounds like he'd rather be playing an aggro deck, and Hellriders is, I think, much better in an aggro deck than Avalanche Riders, but I don't know what you think about that Goodspeed.
I don't know. I don't know what 4-drops Red Aggro wants besides Hero of Oxid Ridge.
I mean, Hellrider is basically a Hero of Oxid Ridge, to be honest. Like, Hero is a little better, but Hellrider is very similar. It just gets through damage without having to, like, interact.
Hellrider be better.
Is better than Hero of Oxid Ridge.
I still think Hero is better, but Hellrider is pretty good.
If you want a video confirmation of that, I think it was Party did a Vintage Cube recently. He had both of them in a pack, and he picked Hellrider over it and explained
close
why.
Close enough to each other that one is better than the other. Like, each is better than the other sometimes.
In Innistrad...
They're not that far apart.
In Innistrad Scars, I played a red-green
deck. He evaluated it as Hellrider, I think, got in 2 more damage than Hero of Oxid Ridge in general.
In Innistrad Scars Standard, I played a red-green deck with Hellrider and Hero of Oxid Ridge, and it was fucking crazy. It was so much fun. I like Hellrider a lot. I think Goodspeed will like it once he plays with it.
The other red 4-drops... We mentioned Avalanche Riders... We mentioned Hero, but there's Flame Tongue Kavu and Koth of the Hammer.
Both of which are great.
Yeah.
Koth's part of the reason I went into red last night, because I wheeled him, I think.
I mean, I think Avalanche Riders is definitely the cut.
I don't know how Hellrider is going to get in the cube yet. Let's put it that way.
Actually, I don't think I wanted to cut the Shock Lands outright. I think you wanted to put them in a special gets added if there are 7 or more drafters place.
The amount of lands is the same per person you add to the cube, right?
Ideally, yeah.
Every player is going to add 4.6 or 5.6 lands to the draft.
True. When you have a higher absolute number of lands, the chances of you just getting a ton of them opened is a lot higher.
But when you have more players, there's just also a lot more of the aggro pieces going around. And there's still,
right.
And there's not going to be as... And I don't think there's going to be any more aggro players with more people added. Like, I think there's generally still just going to be one aggro player.
Sure.
This gets to my last idea. And this is by far the most controversial thing I've thought of.
Oh boy.
What if we draft larger packs and just throw, like, we draft 17 card packs and the last 3 picks are just thrown away?
Well, so this is the Kaz.
I think switching from 15 to 14 is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. I don't know why you did it, and Moto Cube is 15 cards. I don't know where this is coming from, but it's just ridiculous when we only have 4 or 5 people, in my opinion.
So take my idea. Respond to that.
It's certainly better than 14 card packs, but I don't love it, because part of drafting very specific strategies is you can wheel cards close to last pick.
But the last pick is still the 14th for pick.
Sure, but this isn't just for white aggro. It applies to a lot of other archetypes, too.
Okay, but the last pick is still the 14th pick. It's just now you have 4 cards to pick from. It means that there's a higher density of everything available.
Sure.
If we think that is aggro's problem, it's something we've danced around.
I kind of like that idea, but it does sound like kind of crazy. I don't know, it sounds kind of off the wall.
Are you willing to try it?
Yeah, I'm willing to try it.
The only downside I can see is if you get a Yuta pack with just 17 good cards everyone wants.
You could still get 14 good cards everyone wants.
Sure, but then everybody gets those cards, and otherwise you're eliminating them from the draft completely.
That's fine, that'll be interesting.
Meh. I'll try, I don't care.
You really don't think you can find 3 cards that are worse than...
My opinion doesn't matter. You can just put cards in front of me and I'll play Magic.
Your opinion does matter, Speed.
I mean, your opinion is why we're having this conversation.
This power imbalance in the cube isn't something I notice as much as you do, and like I'm glad you're bringing it up, because I generally just play black and green. Those are the colors I usually play. Those are the colors I like playing. And I, you know, when you bring this stuff up, I agree with you. I would like the cube to be more balanced. I would like aggro to be a force that actually draftable. I don't know. I appreciate your opinions.
I'm not complaining because I want to draft white aggro. I'm complaining because it is undraftable and literally no one will do it.
I do also agree with you. Like, I've tried drafting white aggro a few times and it's just fallen through.
Especially recently. Certainly
when
since
I was playing
summer.
When I was playing with Bitter Blossom, like...
Yeah, that was a white-black deck.
That really fell through. Like, I was just like, the white aggro cards, like, it's not working for
right.
me.
My point is, I don't want to draft it. I just want somebody to be drafting it.
So that signals are less muddled. So there's more
right.
more things open.
Yes, exactly.
I get it.
Something I would explore too is that as the power of other things go up, aggro isn't good. Creatures aren't good
aggro,
in the face of vintage cards.
Aggro can win vintage cube. I've seen white aggro do it.
We're not playing vintage cube.
What am I KSM?
The Lunar?
He wasn't talking about the Black McKay.
I guess.
We can try it out.
It's not protection. It gives you any mana drop you want, including a 1-drop.
Sure.
And it pumps everything.
The discussion of Mikaeus I've heard from other cubers in the past has been mediocre. Not exciting. But I'll put it in. It's hard to say.
I'm just trying to give suggestions other than just swap for a Quarters Paladin.
I already know what I want to put Mikaeus in for. You sold me when I remembered Intangible Virtue is still in the cube.
Ew. Are you sure?
I just did an entire inventory of the cube.
Okay.
That's why it was unshuffled.
What's the other... there's the white card that gives white creatures protection or something.
That seems ridiculous.
No, it's in the cube, isn't it?
The instant. Brave the Elements.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's in.
That's the other card I don't like. Spectral Procession.
Here's one other thing I'm noticing right now, looking at the list. Mono White is suffering from the number of cards devoted for a token strategy that doesn't exist.
Like
Spectral Procession.
Besides, is Spectral Procession still in?
Yes.
Interesting.
So is Shrine of Loyal Legions.
I did make a complaint about Spectral Procession last draft.
Yeah,
I think most people agree.
When I was,
those are the cards I identified to cut.
When I was the one that got screwed, Spectral Procession was my card to say, fuck this.
You heard of the buyback one before that?
What's the buyback one?
The one that...
I'm not getting rid of Lingering Souls.
Flashback? No, not Lingering Souls. The one that you had to tap 3 white creatures to flashback.
Oh, the bird thing?
Yeah.
Do you like that?
I like it more than Spectral Procession. I don't really like either of them, but I don't think white-black tokens has been a thing in a long time.
As long as we're on the Exalted section, a Krayson Squire.
What?
That's it.
One for a white 1/1 that has Exalted.
All right, Isamaru it is. I don't think there's anything else to say. We're all on the same page now. What did you get for Christmas, Kaz?
I don't know. I got a razor. It's super boring.
A phone? You got a new phone, too?
No, shut. I need one. My phone doesn't lock anymore. The new OS is causing it to glitch up all the fucking time.
You got a scooter?
No, that would be obnoxious.
Does it have red wheels?
That.
People I used to have a Red Wheels razor.
Go on their scooters or skateboards and make those clicking noises and noise the crap out of me. Have you guys heard of that podcast, like, Welcome to Nightville?
Yeah.
I got their book for Christmas. At least a book.
It's related to Homestuck, right?
I have no idea. I just know that my dad and my brother were really into it, and they made me listen to a part of the podcast. I'm like, this is kind of interesting. And so they got me the book.
If I had paid enough attention on Tumblr at the right part of my life, I probably would be into that. But I'm only tangentially aware of it.
It's pretty weird. That's why I like it. What else did I get? I don't know, I just got a bunch of shit. That's a good thing.
Thanks for the shit, Santa.
Can I give me a Christmas present that I haven't looked at yet?
What? Oh, I already told you what it was. A little gift. We talked about it before.
I gave Kaz the best Christmas present.
Yeah, Karn Liberated.
Really?
That's what I opened for my Modern Masters pack.
Yeah, I know. I figured.
First Kiki, now Karn.
I got a Guilt Leaf Winnower. Wow, what did you get?
Some rares you haven't heard of.
I played the format. I'm willing to bet I have.
Okay, maybe you can help me remember.
Okay.
It was an artifact that gives spirits +1/+1.
Yeah.
And had another effect.
Yep, I remember this part.
Oh, ew.
I don't know what it's called or what the other effect is, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
What a trash rare.
Not in limited.
And I got a foil.
No, in limited it was good.
Yeah.
Creekwood Liege.
Okay.
Oh, shit. That's actually worth a shitload of money. Are you kidding me?
It's not Wiltleaf Liege.
Guilty.
Creekwood was at least, was still over $10, and a foil is going to be worth something.
I didn't expect that to be true, but I didn't look.
Foil is $14.
That was the Shadowmoor version?
Yeah, the Modern Masters one. Oh.
Go on.
$1.50 for the normal.
Jeez,
and $5 for the foil.
Nobody plays it in any format.
It used to be expensive. I don't know why.
All cards from, like, Lorwyn Shadowmoor are expensive now, just because they're old now. But when you reprint them,
yeah.
And there's no demand.
Hashtag, the price on my Kamigawa cards is going up. Glad I got my gifts I'm given now.
No, Goodspeed. I just got you Transistor. It was on sale.
I know.
Oh, okay.
I'm saying, I feel bad that I haven't played it yet. I didn't know what it was. I just meant that I haven't had time to play it.
To play it.
And I want
play
to.
Whatever. I mean, time. We're going to do that, Paul. I'm going to play it and you're going to watch me.
Okay.
Make you watch me. Sure. Oh, I also got, like, I asked for a gift really late because I was really lazy and I wanted a big Totoro plush. And so I just got money for that, and I'm probably going to order that soon. What?
We acknowledge this is what you want, but we don't know how to get it. So you can take care of that yourself.
It's pretty much it.
What about you?
I got a new phone.
You got one other thing that I heard about.
I got a monitor.
And you forgot it at your dad's house.
Yeah, well, whatever. He's having surgery, so I don't get it anyway.
I thought you were just going to get a TV.
They got me a monitor, and I'm not complaining because it looks really nice.
Oh, okay.
I tried to talk him into getting a TV.
Well, okay, so
anyways.
What I sent them was a TV, and apparently my stepmom, like, spent hours researching this and was told to just buy a monitor, so.
Told by a human.
Yeah, by a Best Buy sales rep.
Not by, like, a logical computer program.
No.
So my reason for preferring televisions is that they're typically designed to handle multiple inputs. And they handle more generic inputs like HDMI. Monitors are notorious for having stupid computer inputs and not being able to switch between them.
Can a monitor not have HDMI?
No, they can now. I'm sure it's common. I haven't bought a monitor in a long time.
I mean, as long as it has HDMI, it's all I need.
That's kind of true.
All of my devices just use HDMI.
But when some video game comes out, you said you were going to play the Wii U.
I'll admit, I'm willing to bet my Wii U does not plug into my monitor. But that's not the monitor's fault.
Can you just buy an HDMI? Oh, no. No, it's broken on your console.
Right.
God damn.
But the TV would be able to do it. This is why TVs are better.
I don't believe you. This TV just cannot run my Wii U.
It has AVI inputs.
Does it really?
Yeah, it has one.
What's plugged into it right
TVs
now?
TVs still
Nothing.
Do.
Something's plugged into it right now.
Is it?
There are yellow, red, and white plugs.
Oh, it's the Nintendo 64 cable.
Oh, it's not plugged into anything.
The box with the N64 is right there.
So what's this Wii U game? Is it Zelda?
I didn't... What?
I forget which game you mentioned.
What are we talking about?
This game that you wanted to play on your Wii U.
I don't want to fuck the Wii U. Big piece of shit.
Oh, fuck you! Wii U is awesome.
It's not unawesome.
I'll admit, I've been playing Zelda HD at my roommate's Wii U. It's pretty fun.
The Wind Waker?
Yeah. No, the new Zelda looks really good, and I want to play it when it comes out. That's it, though. Besides that, I don't give a fucking fuck about the Wii U.
I'll have all the power when that happens, huh?
Well, I have one.
Nobody wants to play that in standard definition.
I will, I don't care. I just want to play Zelda.
When does Bayonetta arrive on Smash Brothers? When do I have to give up my Smash Brothers hiatus?
February. Along with Crom. No, not Crom.
Somebody from Fire Emblem
Some
that I couldn't care less about.
The new Fire Emblem Fates game.
And Cloud, who I also couldn't care less about.
Cloud is actually pretty good. I played some with Wes when he came home.
Is he big and slow?
He kind of kicked my ass with it.
Is he big and slow?
No. He's sort of average. The thing that's really good is that he can, like, crouch down and do, like, a slide attack across the ground that you can't shield grab. And it works as, like, a dash attack.
So what did you get for Christmas, Ed? I feel like sharing.
I got a bunch of clothes. I got a Keurig, and I got a coloring book.
A Keurig is something that I've also enjoyed the benefits of having
Keurig.
Around. It's a coffee maker that makes a single cup of coffee at a time.
Oh, okay. So that's what that thing is. Those are single
Yeah, it's with the little red packets. Things over there.
Yeah, we can destroy the world with little plastic cups.
Yeah, I don't mind that. I also have, like, a little mesh one that you can fill with coffee. I just haven't gotten around to opening it.
We could just make them biodegradable.
But there's one that's mesh and refillable, and you just buy coffee and put the coffee in it.
Yeah.
I just haven't put that in yet.
Uh-huh. I look forward to the days of that, too. Then I'll be less guilty about using little plastic cups all the time.
You didn't pay for them. Why do you have any guilt?
My planet, too, damn it. Sometimes I make decisions that are
completely irrelevant.
Anything else before we delve into environmentalism?
Got a shoe polishing kit. That's about it.
Wow.
You could work at an airport in, like, the 50s.
No, it's to polish my shoes. Like, not other people's, just mine.
So for Christmas, I mostly asked for movies and shows that I like, and I got a bunch. I got The Breakfast Club, which is, like...
Sorry.
It's one of Paul's favorite movies.
I like it, but you made me watch it a lot. Let's
see how many times I can aggressively sigh during the rest of these movies.
I got Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That's all the John Hughes, so...
Ooh, it was filmed at my high school.
Don't expect any more. I got Caddyshack.
Really?
You've never seen Caddyshack.
I absolutely have.
Have you?
And I've played half of the music from it during a play, so stop.
Who hadn't seen Caddyshack? Are you sure it wasn't you?
Pretty sure I've seen it.
Are you sure it wasn't Caddyshack 2?
Pretty sure I didn't play the soundtrack to Caddyshack 2 during a musical.
I also got the Firefly, the complete series.
Ugh. I do it for him because I know Ed likes that show.
I have that already. I also have never finished the next one.
Serenity.
Fooly Cooly.
That's an awesome cover.
Freshman year, Albert came into my room with Fooly Cooly and said, "Let's watch Fooly Cooly." And I promptly fell asleep in the first 5 minutes because it was like 2 a.m. when we tried to do this.
I'm not even sure if the time is correct, but it's not the only time that we've tried to show Fooly Cooly to you. Albert and I love the show.
Since then, it had been tried to show me multiple times, and I've probably fallen asleep multiple times.
In the first episode, like, every time.
Fooly Cooly is awesome.
It's only 6 episodes!
So I have to get really engaged to not fall asleep during videos, especially if we're showing them to me, like, after 8 p.m.
I understand. It's a really comforting joke at this point.
Like, I've seen the last episode, kind of, when I wake up because it's making really loud noise.
Yeah.
I have no idea how they get from point A to point B, though.
How expensive was some of this stuff? I know getting some anime and Blu-ray is, like, ridiculous.
I didn't pay for it, but I think Fooly Cooly was $30.
Awesome.
Which isn't cheap.
I mean, I guess that is. It is only, like, movie length, basically.
I think Firefly was probably also $30. I assume the movies were all about 10.
The best part about shopping, too, near Christmas, and this is for clothes, items, etc., if you shop in the beginning of December, don't shop during November when everyone else is going for their "I'm gonna be early and shop." Go in December and everything is on final sale because everyone's turning over and everything is 50% off. Clothes, movies, music, everything.
Why would you buy any of those things?
I mean, clothes, other than that.
I mean, I went to, and still even in January, like, I went to go shopping, like, over the weekend, and I got 3 shirts and a pair of pants for $25.
Shit.
From Banana Republic.
That sounds nice. Addressing Goodspeed and Kaz.
What?
Neither of you have jobs. But now that I have a job, I want to represent myself with buying power. I want to use money to support things I like.
If I get a job, if I plan on not working for the rest of my life, no, not really, but I will buy things I like, but I will... I just want to have all this shit on my computer, honestly, so I'll probably just buy it, like, as, like, token appreciation and just put it somewhere. Be like, fuck it. I'll give money to, like, the...
But that also...
Small bands.
It's also a reason why whatever. I think that it's valuable to purchase them.
Yeah, to try the demo.
Basically, that's what I do.
I just saw the demo to Stanley Parable today. Like, the old one from 2013.
What's the point?
From the mod.
Oh my god, well, because I was watching PewDiePie. It was so good. The demo was so fantastic.
Really?
Have you played his new game?
No.
He has a new, like, 20-minute-long game. It's okay. It's pretty good. It's funny.
Oh, yeah, you play it. It was not 20 minutes. It was, like, 12.
Yeah.
What does it cost? Just a buck?
No, it was free.
It was free.
Oh, okay.
It's called...
Much like Spooky's House of Jump Scares.
Oh, God. Paul, do you remember the name of it? Paul pulled it up on Steam. It's Dr. Langshkov, the Tiger, and the Terribly Cursed Emerald, a whirlwind heist. And it was great. We played it for 18 minutes.
Oh, my God. The new naming strategy that can be added to Cube decks. Dr. Magister of Worth Langishlov, the Titan.
And the terribly cursed Mox Diamond.
And the terribly cursed Kiki Jiki, a fire spout heist.
The terribly cursed Jack in the Box.
I may have cut Jack in the Box.
Yeah, I saw that. It was a little disappointing. But you cut it for Mox Diamond, right?
Well, I cut it...
It's just because it blew up in your face like 3 times in a row, isn't it?
It was appropriate to do because I also cut... I cut that and Booster Shooter, 4 Clockwork Librarians, and Lore Seeker all at once. But I replaced it with Mox Diamond.
Did you replace Booster Shooter?
No.
Okay.
It's not like any of those cards saw play. They just saw draft mode.
Except for Jack in the Box, which always got played in every deck.
I play a lot of Jack in the Box.
My grandma and grandpa gave... I asked for a bunch of movies, but they decided to get me movies that weren't on my list. I got Angels and Demons double-packed with Da Vinci Code.
And we'd like to announce that we're doing our first audio commentary track featuring Ed Randerson.
Literally. What?
No.
So in this one, you'll see some bullshit...
But is we love those movies. Dan Brown's the best.
Yeah, it was the Dan Brown Tom Hanks 2-pack and a cribbage board in the shape of booze.
Hey, cribbage is really fun. I'm really good at it.
I do. I love cribbage. I haven't played it in a while. I kind of forgot.
I returned them both to Best Buy. I can see what my grandma and grandpa...
You can't return a cribbage board to Best Buy. You still got that one.
They don't sell those there.
So I can see what my grandparents were thinking, because I asked for 2 Tom Hanks movies, but neither of those Tom Hanks movies. Any guesses?
Big and extremely loud and incredibly boring.
That's a movie now?
Yeah, it was terrible.
I read that book as a sophomore.
Apparently it was a really good book.
It was an okay book, well, but I'm an autistic kid, like an autistic kid.
Yeah, when post 9/11, my dad's dead mood.
Yeah, they thought that their dad was still alive, and it was really depressing.
Yeah, well, apparently the movie was awful. Moving on.
So the two movies, okay, you guys could guess these. Each of you has reasons to guess these.
I don't know who Tom
is. I know what one of them is, but I'm not going to say it, because that would imply I know what it is.
And
you're already doing
what's
that.
What's the other one?
I think I can see the character that Tom Hanks plays in one of them, but I can't remember what movie it is.
You don't want Castaway, do you? Tom Hanks movies.
One of them is
a
movie that...
Stutter in one of them?
He stars in a bunch of things.
Stutter.
Stutter? I don't know. He has a weird accent in one of them.
Is it The Terminal?
No. I'm gonna say...
Toy Story!
No.
Is he in Toy Story?
The Polar Express!
You're just trolling me now.
What, you mean it's not the Polar Express?
Cloud Atlas.
Oh, God, yeah, okay. Oh, okay. The other one's Catch Me If You Can.
It is, yeah.
Catch Me If You Can? Is that a Leonardo DiCaprio movie?
Yes.
Yet another...
Tom Hanks co-star.
Another project.
Why would you describe that as a Tom Hanks movie?
Because there's 2 characters in the movie!
Tom Hanks is the other character.
Christopher Walken's a character for like the first 20 seconds.
If you would call Pulp Fiction a Christopher Walken movie, I think you can count Catch Me If You Can as a Christopher Walken movie.
It's much more a Tom Hanks movie than a Christopher Walken movie.
Pulp Fiction?
No. Yes. Why not?
Speaking of Pulp Fiction, you know what's great?
What?
A movie called The
Ridiculous
Eight.
Six?
Yeah. highest grossing Netflix movie ever, I read today.
Are you serious?
Yep.
Why?
Because people are fucking stupid.
What's it about?
Adam Sandler.
And?
He's Adam Sandler, and he's in the movie.
What is it about?
And he's Adam Sandler, and he's gonna do things. And it's a Western. And Adam Sandler's in it. And Taylor Lautner's in it. You like him. And you've probably heard the name of the movie before.
I don't like Taylor Lautner.
You know something about Westerns and numbers. Lautner. And Adam Sandler's in it. He's funny.
I think it's the guy who played Gambit.
What? In the Spider-Man movies, right?
Isn't that Will I Am?
He didn't play Gambit. He played, like, another guy who could teleport.
Wait, can Gambit teleport?
No.
He just charges cars with kinetic energy.
Yeah.
Nightcrawler can teleport.
I don't know why he chooses cards, but...
So you like The Hateful Eight?
Yeah, best movie of the last year.
Really?
I don't think most people will like it. I think Paul will love it.
I disagree, it's Kingsman.
Ed might like it. I have no idea how you'd feel about it, Kaz.
I saw it already.
Oh, what'd you think?
It's good.
Okay.
I have a question for you. Tarantino movies. I didn't think it was anything spectacular or out of the ordinary for his normal film, but I enjoyed watching it. It was fun.
It's a Tarantino movie?
Yeah.
Goodspeed thinks that I, in particular, would like it. Do you have that impression?
Mm-hmm. What do you like? Don't you just like everything?
So I'm gonna go with no, you don't have that impression.
And do you like other Tarantino movies?
Isn't it basically
Reservoir Dogs?
Okay, that is his only movie I haven't seen. And
I haven't seen it either.
I think somebody
told me that, okay. I'm just gonna repeat it.
Wow.
Vague knowledge of Reservoir Dogs, I think, leads you to the assumption that it's like Reservoir Dogs. I think it's a huge divergence from his normal movie. Yeah, because usually his movies are like really action-packed and fast. And, like, everything's changing.
Unnecessary gore.
Okay, that was in this movie. But it felt more appropriate than usual in this movie.
You know, no, I agree.
Every death had more impact in this than it normally does in a Tarantino movie.
Yeah. I hate it when Tarantino talks in this movie. I fucking hate his voice.
I
fucking hate him.
Was he in this one?
No, he was just talking. He was like, after the
intermission,
he was
the narrator.
He was like, oh, then this happened and this happened. And it's like, shut
in
up
a vague
and
sense,
show it to us.
I have a question for you. After what chapter was the intermission? Because they didn't show it at my showing.
It was at... Oh, I don't want to spoil it.
Was it... Had you heard narration yet before it?
No.
Okay, then yeah.
It was right before
the
narration.
Okay, I know exactly where it was then. Okay. Okay. No, anyway.
Did they have an intermission with you?
No, they just didn't show it. They cut it completely. I walked in with a full iced tea and I was like, there's the intermission, I'll be fine. I was like, nope, 3 hours later. But no, yeah, I thought it was way better than Star Wars. I thought it was better than Mad Max.
Well, I thought it was better than Star Wars.
I don't know.
I liked Mad Max a lot.
I'm not trying to start a flame war. I'm just naming some of the best movies people think of.
Of course it was better than Mad Max.
You say the year. No, well, I think
I liked Mad Max.
All I can say.
Yeah, they're both very good.
We all liked Mad Max a lot, except you, who had the exact opposite reaction.
Yeah. About Hateful Eight, I did like how, like, I couldn't really see anything coming, like, that much. I knew that... I can't talk about it.
Sure.
Yeah, I really know nothing about the film at this point. Like, almost nothing.
Yeah, we'll keep it spoiler and detail free. I thought it was a good movie. I liked all the characters.
It is a good movie. I liked it.
It certainly achieved what it set out to accomplish. And that's pretty much all I want to see from a movie.
I hate that cop-out. And you guys say it every time you evaluate a movie.
That's because...
It accomplished what it set out to accomplish.
I don't know.
And I recently heard someone evaluate movies saying, they made a fucking movie about dogs painting things. You can do whatever you want as long as you do what you want to accomplish.
I kind of agree with you. I don't know what Goodspeed thinks. I prefaced it with the fact that I think it was good, but it wasn't spectacular. I just thought, like I said, it was kind of just what I wanted to see. It was interesting. I didn't think it was amazing because it was...
Why is the bar so low in what makes cinema acceptable?
Because so many movies are so bad.
Compare it to everything else and it's, like, amazing.
I think that a lot of movies fail at doing that.
It's true.
Well, for example, we're just talking about Adam Sandler. He doesn't even try. There is no effort put into anything in his movies because they never plan it. They just did it for money. Do you want to say artistic goals? Because that's closer to what I'm trying to say.
Because I just don't understand why cinema is so bad.
Neither do I. I think it's because it's way easier.
I can relatively easily just walk into a bookstore and pick up any book and be happy reading it.
But you feel similarly about movies, don't you?
No.
But I thought your whole thing was that you don't enjoy most movies.
That's my point.
Okay, and that's also my point, is you feel the same way about movies as you do as books. It's just a different feeling.
No, I can be confident when I'm picking up a published book that it's at least got some kind of thought into what was being portrayed.
Okay.
I don't feel that with movies.
I want to get bogged down.
I feel like when I go into a movie, it can just be absolutely any schlock.
Right. And you're asking why that's the state of the industry?
Yeah.
I think the people who pay to have the movies made don't care if it's good or not.
Because schlock makes money.
Right. That people are just stupid and they want to... People... I don't want to imply people that read books are smarter, but I think people who read books are smarter.
I'm going to guess the audience for books and movies overlaps a lot.
Sure, but I think it's easier to pay $10 to go sit for 2 hours and watch things happen than it is to sit down with a book and read it for, I don't know, at least 5 hours.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
But there's also, like, different things that people expect out of the different media.
Sure.
Like, I mentioned it to you before, like, when I'm talking about a movie, I'm okay just having fun.
Right.
Having a fun experience. But if I want a book, like, I want, like, a really deeper, more meaningful experience. And I think that's something that just comes across in the form that, like, the media, like, something built into
people
it.
People are okay going to a movie and just drooling versus having to think.
Basically, you can sum this up as reading is an active experience and watching a movie is a passive one.
If you want it to be.
Yeah.
Because I don't think...
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I don't think you can say we watch movies passively anymore.
I agree with that, too. Reading or watching a movie can be a passive experience.
Right. I think it is for a lot of people. I don't think it should be. I think you're helping to kill it as an art form if you view it that way. But I'm not really going to... I don't want to tell you you're a bad person for doing that, because it's your right.
I can't convince you to think more.
Right. It's like, if you're enjoying it, fine, keep doing it. I feel like you could do that at movies that are also good.
I never heard... What did you think of Star Wars? Did you pretty much mirror...
Meh. It was at best a B-. I put this out when I walked out. I told my sister, I can't hum a single tune from that movie that wasn't already in a previous movie. And that was the most disappointing part
for
me.
Yeah, the music wasn't very good.
Right. Nothing was new. It was just the same story again.
Yeah, I mean, I agree.
And it bothered me how much of it was marketing, but it's debatable how much it's marketing.
There's some new things in Star Wars, though. You can stop lasers with the Force now.
That was cool.
They did that in Episode 5. Darth Vader absorbed it with his hand, which
absorbed,
is infinitely cooler.
Did not just
Mandalorian
stop it.
Gauntlet?
Yeah, that's cooler than stopping it, in my opinion.
I don't know.
Being able to go, I don't take damage, is cooler than going, I can stop damage.
Lightsabers have personality.
So Platinum Angel is cooler than Platinum and
because
Iron.
The fiery one was kind of, like, chaotic.
I think, yeah, but that wasn't... An aesthetic choice. He just doesn't know how to make a real lightsaber.
I think it was an aesthetic choice.
By the
his personality informs as an informed by his lightsaber blade. Lightsabers don't have character up until this point in the Star Wars universe.
Sure, and I'm not saying
except for color, kind of.
I don't think I think it was obviously a decision by people who made the movie. But in the world, I don't think he wanted his lightsaber to look like that. Based on what I know about his character, I think he would have wanted a perfect Darth Vader lightsaber.
Maybe.
And he just can't do it because he never finished his training. Or his training has been so inadequate thus far.
Even though he's training under some super secret.
Let's put it this way. He didn't have a fancy lightsaber instead of a personality.
Sure. Yeah. You know what Disney needs to do?
Darth Maul.
They need to rename that part of Disney World in Orlando to the Darth Maul. The place with all the shards.
Sliding lightsaber.
Which one?
There was like a sliding bow staff lightsaber in a video game that looked pretty cool.
What?
I mean, that might be true, but the video games aren't canon anymore.
It wasn't actually sliding. It's just like the lightsaber would extend in one end and then decrease on the other so that you could swing it more.
Sounds like something in a game, but those aren't canon.
Yeah. Okay. That one was cooler than the one with, like, a cross on it.
And then we have Count Dooku, and his is bent.
But it's basically exactly the same thing. Alright, so we should stop before we get into Star Wars spoilers. I think that's it for the Take 9 of the Untapped podcast. You can hit us up on Twitter at UntappedClick. Send us an email at untappedclick@gmail.com. That's it. Da 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 da